complete victory. The destruction of German militarism. Victory march on Berlin. Slow, deliberate fire is being maintained on the enemy positions. At this moment, my men are advancing across no man's land in full pack, dressing from left to right. The men are forbidden under pain of court-martial to take cover in any shell hole or dugout. Their magnificent morale will cause the enemy to flee in confusion. The attack will be driven home with the bayonet. I feel that every step I take is guided by the divine will.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 6th of February 2026, streaming live. Yes, live. It seems like the first time for months we've been live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol City Centre. We're actually in the nursery at the Cumber Centre in Hepburn Road, close to the city centre, and don't believe a word we say. But we do try to share, you know, I'm not going to do one of those. Yeah, we're the truth. It's okay, you can trust us. BCFM, Politics Show, Bristol Politics Show, verify, no. But we do try, because, you know, that the idea is that listeners are smart enough to decide whether they're being lied to or not. So we're not pretending that everything we say is right. In fact, sometimes, of course, we're not right, but we do our best, which is more than can be said from the trillions of pounds and dollars that are spent on these mainstream media outlets all around the West. But we do try to share a few moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port, turned merchant venture of fiefdom in the City of London's UK Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, on djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, on holylandradio.com between 11 a.m. and 12:30 p.m. Central Time, 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, or Bristol Politics Show app, as it now is, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. This show repeats at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week, if you happen to miss it live, and that's right here on the Talk Radio stream. That's talkradio.org.uk, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. So tonight, quite obviously, Epstein. But Epstein and what? Epstein and the KGB, or is it Epstein and the Rothschilds? Now, there's a question. Robert Maxwell, or is it really about Ghislaine Maxwell? Is it all really about Ghislaine Maxwell? Was Ghislaine Maxwell abusing men and women all at the same time? But we also got an exclusive this week with a chap called the Reverend Paul Williamson. He was the one who was nearly pushed down the steps of St. Paul's Cathedral last week during Archbishop Sarah Mullally's initiation, whatever it is, announced that she's going to be the new Archbishop of Canterbury. And he joins me to explain, first of all, what happened to him when he tried to raise an objection in St. Paul's to her being made Archbishop, and then in some detail what his actual objection is. And it is actually concerning, because it sounds to me as if it's every bit as bad as the previous Archbishop Welby, what he was ejected for doing. So it seems to me, maybe, you know, they're only putting people in these jobs when they've got dirt on them, and you've got to behave yourself or we will unleash the dirt and unleash you from the job. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with the accelerationist zero trust agenda psyops. Have the cabinet sold their souls to the devil? Well, they certainly seem to have sold them to the Prince of Darkness, don't they? Because the politicians just have nothing to say, and everything that comes out of Starmer's mouth now has got paedophile, child sex abuser, child trafficker written all over it, hasn't it? So why on earth, on how on earth, could any self-respecting nation allow someone like that to continue in the job? Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment, Social Darwinist Control Freaks and Underlings want us as slaves to their AI or dead. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Wef King Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. Anyone who's not their mates, actually. The Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn children, and the only right they want us to have is our so-called right to kill ourselves with the help, like the jabs, of a doctor. Netanyahu's the king of chaos, rolling out a red carpet for the Zionist man-god Antichrist Messiah to come, maybe. But it's not the end of the world, or is it? So anyway, helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's Fourth Reich here in Bristol, Britain, and around the world is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
You've been actually staying at my flat, haven't you, this week? I thought it was an interesting, entertaining little thing to happen. Why was that?
Because I was having my flat painted.
And is it all nice and...
Yes, it's
gorgeous.
Now painted.
Now it looks more civilised, does it?
Yeah.
I think it's probably worth relating to the listeners. We actually had some fun watching Peter Greenaway films, which you hadn't seen before. I can remember watching The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover when it first came out back in, I think it was 1989, and being incredibly impressed by it. But what did you make of his type of filmmaking? He works very closely with the musician Michael Nyman. And these come across as really kind of epic films, but they're not to everyone's taste, are they?
Well, no. I mean, they're very arty in a kind of pretentious sort of a way. It's not like mainstream Hollywood filmmaking.
Well, that's just I don't find it pretentious. I don't.
Well,
I just find I found it actually deeply. Really kind of satirical, really, about the way the British establishment operates. So The Cook, the Thief and His Wife and Her Lover stars Helen Mirren, Michael Gambon. It's even got Ian Dury putting in an appearance. And it's about a sort of gangster London elite, which is not so far from reality.
Well, yes, but at the same time, it's a magical realist reality, isn't it? It's not reality, which is okay. I mean, films can be about, you know, have all sorts of... methods of communicating.
And considering it was all filmed in Elstree Studios, which I only looked up whilst I was watching it, there's no location filming at all. I think it was an amazing job, well done. And I think Greenaway at the time realised that he could see the British film industry collapsing around him. And he's one of those people a bit like Troy Kennedy Martin with some of his later productions. And you can see they're actually saying, well, you know, soon this whole film production industry is not going to be, so let's just make the most extreme thing we can before the whole industry snuffed out.
Well, that may be so. I mean, I'm
they
not
are still
really
making
a film
films.
Buff, to be
no,
honest.
They are still
I
making.
Know
you are. You're quite, you know what, Martin? You are, because you quite often tell me, "Oh, you should watch this film," or you mention a film which is extreme. You were talking about this Russian film, weren't you? About Belarus, for example.
It's a Belarusian film. Belarusian film.
Right.
Yeah. Come and See, which is about Second World War. And it's, you know, quite a powerful anti-war film,
yeah,
as all the best war films are.
Yeah, well, I mean, and also, you know, this is it. If I don't think anyone minds the a little bit of debauchery on screen, if so long as it's there's a point to it. And it seems to me the film industry now just does this stuff for the sake of it. Back at least in the late 80s, it was. Anyway, let's move on to have a look at some of the news for this week. And we've got lots to talk about with all these Epstein revelations. But before we just totally get into some of the local stories, quite important ones actually, are... What do you make of this idea that really Starmer has now completely lost all credibility? It's obvious now that his ambassador to the United States was, at least allegedly, we have to say that, he hasn't actually been charged, so maybe we don't have to say that. It does appear as if he's been committing misconduct in public office as basically a spy in the cabinet. So important, sensitive financial information is just being emailed off to Epstein.
Well, obviously, there's an ongoing police investigation. They were raiding places this afternoon, I understand. It's a big political problem for Starmer. But, of course, the Epstein files don't just concern Mandelson. They concern lots of different people. And, of course, it's interesting that we haven't had all the files released.
You're trying to steer it away from the Mandelson topic, because Mandelson is a key person in the Labour Party, your party.
I'm just pointing out that he's not the only person in the frame here.
It's actually, I think, the impact of this release from Trump is possibly going to be mostly felt here in the UK. It might be.
Yes, but what you pointed out when we were talking, you know, at your house this week, was this is very similar to the MPs' expenses scandal, where they had the Barclay brothers and the Telegraph had all the details of everybody's expenses, and in actual fact, they picked out people they were going to expose.
Destroy.
And other people, like Tony Blair, for example, we still don't know what his expenses were.
That was all done with the Daily Telegraph. So
that's all done
individual,
by the Daily Telegraph.
Actually, I think it's worth revisiting that, because we discovered, didn't we, that it was some former MI6 officer.
No,
it
was an ex-SAS guy.
SAS, that's right.
He was bankrupt. And he broke into the House of Commons.
Do you remember his name?
I've forgotten the name now, but we can check it. He broke in and stole the files. Yeah,
a hard drive from the Speaker's office.
That's right. So it wasn't as if there was a leak. He broke in and stole it, and he should probably have been prosecuted for that, because this was secret information. It was private information. And then once the Barclay brothers got hold of it, they then used it to remake the Tory party in the image of David Cameron flew out to meet them in Brecon in their villain's castle in Sark. And they used it to get rid of people they wanted to get rid of, and some people were completely protected. So Tony Blair's file of what expenses he'd got was not released at all. Meanwhile, of course, they released Jeremy Corbyn's file, which showed that he'd actually stolen nothing whatsoever. He's the only one that didn't actually claim anything that he wasn't supposed to claim. So right, that backfired from that point of view.
I'm not sure the AI of Google wants to tell me, but the middleman was a guy called John Wick,
yes,
who's managing
right.
director of International Security Solutions.
That's right. He was
brokered the data transfer to the press, which means he was being paid for it. And
that's
he was
right.
deciding what was going to go and what wasn't.
Well, he gave it to the Barclay brothers, and then they decided, in consultation with others, who was going to be given broken legs. Because what they would do, some people, they will say, well, we're going to bring out that you had expenses for this, this, and this. Decide what you're going to say about it. Other people, they phoned them directly and said, we've got evidence that you did this and this and this, and we want you to answer now, this minute. And, of course, Tony Blair's was never released at all. Yeah, so I think this is what's going on with the Epstein files now. People that are going to be taken down, stuff is being released about them, but at least a third of the files haven't been released, and that'll be the people that they're protecting. Because what Congress said was we want to see all the files without any redaction whatsoever. So what they're doing is dribbling the files out in a redacted fashion so that they can then steer the narrative in the direction they want it to go.
There is a bit of that. There certainly is a bit of that. But there's also, I was reading I think it's the Justice Department's explanation as to the criteria they used whether or not to release the files and the photographs, because there's a whole load of emails and photographs. So this was to do with nudity, so if someone had been photographed in the nude, they wouldn't release those, and they were also to do with serious abuse going on in the picture or in the text of an email, and also death. So anyone where I don't know if there were pictures of dead people in there, it sounds to me as if they may well have been.
Well, the fact is that Congress passed a law to say that all of these files should be released.
Including the compromising pictures of people who were which were taken by Epstein. Now, that's...
Yes, that's what Congress instructed the presidential office to do.
You can see why that isn't really going to work, isn't it? So someone has just gone to visit Epstein innocently, although it's not necessarily, I mean, in his house or whatever, and there's then been filmed getting changed, and a picture of them naked should not be released to the press, should it?
The Congress have just passed a law to say that all of these things should be released.
Martin, you're getting like a stuck record. Can you understand why, say, for example, if you had happened to go in to see Epstein to maybe even investigate him and stayed there a night and got undressed, that it would not be right and correct to release naked pictures of you to the press?
The political system in the US is that the Congress makes laws and
can
then
you just
the executive
answer yes
has to
or no?
No, because in actual fact, we need to see all of these files, don't we?
If we're going to make
a judgment.
You think naked photographs of you should have been released?
Yes. Absolutely. I shouldn't have been there in the first place, should I?
Well, I just don't think you understand what the press
no,
is.
No, what's and happening here is a manipulation of the narrative, Tony. That's
you
what
don't
I'm,
understand.
So I'm getting
so
at.
So what
it.
I'm saying is the truth is in between somewhere. Whether there may well be files which have been kept back and rightly, and there may well be files which have been kept back wrongly. So there
the
has to be...
The only excuse for keeping files back is to protect the identity of victims. But in actual fact, the files they've released have actually named lots of victims who were not happy.
Well,
saying, hang on a minute,
fine.
I didn't want
But you could say that everybody that walked into any of Epstein's establishments was a victim.
Right, and of course, what
you
we
could
have to
say,
do...
Actually,
are
Martin,
we going to investigate Martin, this? We could just close
could,
the whole thing down and not bother
say,
to look into
well,
any
no
of it.
No one's saying that. Oh, they don't be ridiculous. You could actually say that Epstein himself was a victim of Ghislaine Maxwell being brought into this whole operation and victim of the Israeli intelligence.
Israeli intelligence is what we're not hearing about, isn't it? So all of this stuff about sex, different sexual acts and all the rest of it, the fundamental thing here is that Israeli intelligence were blackmailing the political and administrative elite of the West so that they could carry out a genocide in Gaza. That is not... We've got wall-to-wall coverage of Mandelson and nobody's mentioning what's the elephant in the room. Genocide in Gaza, Mossad blackmailing all of our politicians through illegal acts, which means that people should be sent to prison. And of course, in the US, they've still got a death penalty. But we're not talking about these things, are we? So there's a huge effort to steer the narrative around all of this in directions which powerful people want it to go in. Some people are going to be thrown to the wolves. Mandelson looks like he's going to be. Others are going to be protected. And that's what's going on.
So who do you think was the real mastermind? Was it someone over in Tel Aviv? Was it Epstein? Was it Ghislaine Maxwell?
It's somebody inside Mossad. Epstein's handlers. And of course the CIA are also implicated in all of this. And no doubt MI6. They had Christopher Steele, who's an ex-MI6 officer, on the television when I was around at your house, on Sky News, and he was going on action. The real story here is that Epstein was working for Putin, which no doubt we will come to later in this discussion.
We will later, but
can you see what they're trying to do here?
Before that, Martin, let's have a listen to the news about Palestine action this week from the Elbit 5, I think. Is it the Elbit 6 or the Elbit 5?
Elbit 6.
Right.
Emerging after 18 months in custody, one of the most emotive and divisive trials in recent memory, with a jury just as torn. It was in the early hours of August the 6th last year that six members of Palestine Action crashed through a warehouse door in a retired police van and into a factory based in Filton near Bristol, owned by the subsidiary of an Israeli arms firm, Elbit Systems.
I'm leaving.
Okay, leave that.
Emerging dressed in red jumpsuits and carrying sledgehammers, they filmed themselves smashing equipment they believed was to be used in Gaza before being confronted by three security guards, one here wearing black. The police arrived moments later. The prosecution argued the six defendants were meticulously organised and there to cause as much damage as possible, carrying weapons to threaten or, if necessary, harm anyone who got in their way.
If you swing that once more at me, it's going to get really serious.
The defence instead said they hadn't expected to be confronted by security guards and were completely out of their depth.
It's time to leave.
All six were accused of aggravated burglary, criminal damage and violent disorder, but today at Woolwich Crown Court, all six were found not guilty of aggravated burglary, with three of them, Jordan Devlin, Fatima Rajwani and Zoe Rogers, found not guilty of violent disorder. On all other counts, the jury was hung, including on the additional count of GBH against Samuel Corner.
Get your hands out now!
Corner was accused of fracturing the spine of Police Sergeant Kate Evans, seen here at the top of the screen. The defence lawyer for the 23-year-old argued that he had chemical spray in his eyes, that he never meant to use violence, and was trying to protect a co-defendant, who you see here shouting out during an altercation with another police officer. He approaches PS Evans as she assists the arrest on all fours, bringing the sledgehammer down on her back. P.S. Evans told the court she had to take 3 months off work after an x-ray showed a lumbar spine fracture and that she was still on restricted duties a year later. She said Corner had told her following his handcuffing that she was complicit in genocide. All six defendants argued that they'd set out only to damage weapons and stop the factory operating. All apart from Samuel Corner were released on bail today. Their supporters gathered outside the court.
Now, the defendants have already served 18 months in prison without a single conviction. Effectively, I think we can all agree that that effectively is enough punishment for people who were never even convicted.
There was a fiery legal debate at the heart of this trial over intention. One defence barrister compared his client to the suffragettes. Another said hers had been acting out of compassion for the people of Gaza. And then towards the end of the trial, a note was passed from jury to judge asking whether, if the defendants had genuinely thought they were saving lives by breaking equipment, they could be found not guilty of criminal damage. The judge said no and repeated what he'd said at the outset of the trial, that the case must be judged on the evidence alone, regardless of whether the defendants or the jury, for that matter, believed that they were morally justified. Today's case is a blow for the CPS, which will spend the next week deciding whether or not to seek a retrial. A further 18 defendants are yet to be tried this year on charges related to the alleged break-in at Elbit Systems, and a further five over an alleged break-in at an RAF base. Several have been on hunger strike to protest their bail conditions.
Free, free! Palestine!
Last August, the Home Office banned the organisation under terror legislation, making it a crime to support them.
Well, Prescription is not about protest around Palestine or Gaza, where we had, I think, tens of thousands of people protesting lawfully just this weekend about some of the horrendous events that we've seen in the Middle East. Instead, Prescription is about one narrow group that has been involved in violent attacks, including injuries, including weapons.
Since then, according to Amnesty International, more than 2,700 people have been arrested, a move described as disturbing by the UN Human Rights Chief, who said terror laws had been misused to encompass conduct already criminal under the law. Whether the prescription was lawful or not is being considered by British courts in a judicial review, with a decision expected within weeks. Just as this, the first of several trials, ends in deadlock.
So that was Channel 4 News covering it, but quite a lot of other news outlets hardly seem to cover it at all. I think, a moment of pride for Bristol, really, that there was a serious acts committed against a genocide going on in Gaza. And actually, there were, although not all of these cases have apparently been quite decided by the jury, that there's been no convictions at all. Most of these people have done 18 months or so in prison for nothing.
That's right. I mean, I think the juries, they've clearly, there was a majority verdict on some of it, and some of it they just couldn't come to a verdict, which means that they have to let them go. The Crown Prosecution Service will now have to decide whether they're going to, you know, appeal or try and challenge this. But I think
five of them have been bailed. One is still in jail, even though he hasn't been convicted of anything.
Well, that's because he's the one that they claim carried out an act of violence against the police officer. His defence is that it was a very messy situation and he didn't realise he was hurting and all the rest of it. But anyway, I think this, what it definitely suggests is quite a lot of other people are ready to go to trial for various things, the Breeze-Norton attack and so on. And it's what Palestine Action people have been saying all along, which is once we get in front of a jury, it's quite likely they're not going to convict. And that this is the reason why the state has tried to drag these trials out as long as possible, because the punishment is the 18 months they've already done, as you pointed out.
So
for doing nothing, which are, you know, in criminal terms, they've been vindicated.
So the Filton Six are Charlotte Head, Samuel Corner, Leona Cameo, Fatima Rajwani, Zoe Rogers and Jordan Devlin, and coroner accused grievous bodily harm with intent. There was no verdict on that. Aggravated burglary, that was all not guilty. Criminal damage was all no verdict. And a mixture with violent disorder of no verdict and not guilty. So I suppose it's fair to say that none of them have actually been completely exonerated because there was no verdict. Now, you can see what's going to happen here, quite possibly, is they're going to say, oh dear, we got no verdict, we're going to have to start again.
Well, the Crown Prosecution Service will have to justify that, because if it goes to another court, in front of another jury, and they don't get a verdict, then that's a waste of public funds.
And that's just for the criminal damage, which is in many ways the least important of the charges, that there's been no verdict.
Well, that's right. And I think what the defence lawyer said but very carefully, he said that the judge has told you that you can't take account of their
motivations. He's addressing the jury.
He's addressing the jury. And he said, the judge has told you that you can't take account of their motivations. Now, I'm not going to challenge the judge. That's what he says, and that's what the rules are. But I do remind you that you do have an absolute right to convict or not convict, depending upon what you think. So, you know, the judge can't direct you. And, of course, this is what led to the not guilty verdict in the Colston statue affair, which is that the jury basically refused to convict because they accepted that the defendants had acted in good faith for the reasons that they said. Now, of course, the problem for the state is that juries aren't biddable, which is why they were got rid of in the six counties when the Diplock courts were brought in, because they knew that juries wouldn't necessarily convict.
This is in Northern Ireland. Yeah, well, it's also David Lammy now talking about wanting to get rid of jury trials. Is that a coincidence? Of course it's not.
Well, they want to get rid of jury trials, A, because they're expensive, and there is an issue
It's like saying elections are expensive. They're also saying that, aren't they? But apparently supporting Zelensky is not expensive.
No, I know. In other words, it's just an excuse. The jury system in Britain over many hundreds of years has, in fact, been an effective curb on executive power. And it's worked that way quite a lot historically. If you read your E.P. Thompson about the 18th and 19th centuries, I mean, juries in Britain have consistently failed to do what the state wanted to happen. Mm. And that's why they're regarded as such a key part of the legal system going back to 1215 and Magna
Carta.
That's
right, you've got these three things, haven't you, really? The judiciary, the state, and the media. The media seems to me to be becoming increasingly compliant with the state and with the city and with financial interests. But that's not so easy to do if you're going to have juries, is it?
No, I mean, from the state's point of view, juries are just unpredictable. They just want them to be there to rubber stamp what the state wants to happen, which is why, of course, Assange never got put in front of a jury. They spent loads and loads of time trying to make him, you know, find ways to extradite him where we wouldn't have to sit in front of a jury. Because they knew that a jury is quite likely, when they hear the full balance of the arguments, to not agree with what the state wants.
Now, do you think the Filton Six will be entitled to being compensated? Because they've been being kept in jail for something which the jury's now said it's not a crime.
Well, I imagine they'll be talking to their lawyers about exactly that. That's what I'd be doing. You know, I want some compensation.
Why were they being kept in prison?
Because the purpose of why the charges against them are actually a sort of hodgepodge of charges, and
aggravated burglary, criminal damage, violent disorder.
Yes, but people would normally be bailed for any of that. If there was no politics involved, you'd just be bailed. And of course, what they're doing is they're trying to make the trials as far in the future as possible, and they're putting people in prison because they know that when it comes to trial, they're likely to be let off. But they've already done 18 months in prison.
What about a chilling effect that it would have on other activists?
So
there's a double chilling effect. First of all, you haven't been convicted. We're not going to bail you. Even though you've now been found innocent, we're going to put you in prison. And also, we're going to proscribe Palestine Action too.
Yes, and of course loads of people have been arrested for simply expressing support for Palestine Action, not for doing anything else. They haven't done anything else apart from holding a piece of paper saying they support Palestine Action. The state has got itself into a big problem with all of this, because in actual fact a lot of this, when it comes down to it, isn't necessarily legal.
Is the Israel lobby involved? It must be, surely.
Of course it is, yes.
I mean, they've been in the judiciary, in the Crown Prosecution Service, and in the Home Office particularly. Now, we've seen people like Yvette Cooper and now Shabana Mahmood, all sorts of fingers pointing at them saying, well, actually, you're an Israel lover.
Well, it's not just that they're an Israel lover. They've been in contact with the Israeli embassy and various other Israeli interests around these cases.
So are they just pliable, or have they been threatened?
They are pliable. You don't get to be at the top of politics in Britain or the United States unless you've been vetted.
Do the Israelis have dirt on these people, do you think?
They don't need to have dirt. Right. It's also your career. If you want to get ahead, I mean, Yvette Cooper, for example, has taken quite a lot of money from Israeli-linked business people for her own personal campaigns, you know, to pay for her office and so on. So, there's, you know, it's silver or lead, you know. If you work with us, we will help you and get you re-elected. Massey, the congressman, Republican congressman, who's outspoken against Israel, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee are chucking millions of dollars at to try and get him deselected. So what happens is, if you go against what they want, they make your life a misery, try to get you deselected, you know, come up with ridiculous allegations against you, etc., like David Miller and so-called anti-Semitism at Bristol University. And the other way that they get people is, if you get in, you know, you get on side with us, we will look after you and your career will be good. Look at Mandelson, classic greasy pole climber. And of course, you know, that's positive. You know,
I think he was the greaser of the poles.
Well, indeed, that's right. So, you know, the point is, it's as they say in Latin America, it's silver or lead. Yeah, you cooperate with us, we'll look after you. If you don't, we'll kill you, basically.
So, in the background to all of this, of course, is that case I mentioned, which is all about the attempt to deproscribe Palestine Action. Do you think that this case here in Bristol might have an influence on that?
Well, there's two cases. One in Scotland, which has been brought by Craig Murray, because the Scottish legal system is different. And there's one in Britain as well, in England and Wales. And, you know, the argument being made is that, you know, this is not a terrorist organisation. It's a non-violent direct action organisation. It shouldn't be classified as a terrorist group, which I think is pretty obvious to everybody.
So the argument is, from the Home Office, is that these people say they're non-violent, but actually there's some evidence anyway that at least one of these people was actually violent.
Well, that's still obviously a bone of contention. The guy concerned is actually a maths, he's doing a further maths degree at Oxford University, and he suffers from autism. And his defence is, this was all very messy and confused, and I didn't really know what was happening, and I didn't go out with the intention of hurting anybody. But, of course, it turned into a bit of a bundle, because the police arrived. The security guards should have just called the police.
It's quite interesting.
They're not supposed to intervene.
It's interesting to see this judicial review we were talking about Palestine Action being deproscribed, has got an interesting bunch of witnesses. I mean, you're talking here about likes of Quakers and Amnesty turning up.
Well, that's right, because it is, in fact, an attempt to criminalise non-violent direct action, and which is already criminal. I mean, you know, you can be arrested for carrying out criminal damage on a weapons factory. But on the other hand, is that terrorism? And the answer is probably not. It isn't. I mean, previously, Keir Starmer defended people who, when he was a lawyer, defended people who broke into Fairford Air Base and tried to damage US military planes around the Iraq War. And he defended them on the grounds that, you know, this was carried out as a political protest, and that they should be, you know, not, you know, that they should be let off on the basis that's what was going on. And that was what he argued in court when he was a lawyer before he became a prime minister.
So the question, of course, is over Mandelson. Most important, probably, of all of the various accusations in terms of law, is Mandelson's sending at least three separate occasions, possibly more, confidential cabinet information over to Epstein. So let's have a listen now to the news that came yesterday that the Metropolitan Police are actually investigating. We hear, I think, this morning, Martin, that Mandelson's home, the police have turned up there, and they're in order to interview him and search it.
Gone the first time, gone the second time, gone for good.
The Clerk of the Parliament has today received notification from Lord Mandelson of his intention to retire from the House.
Peter Mandelson has left politics and Parliament for the last time, renouncing his seat in the House of Lords, rather than waiting to be kicked out. All over his repeated lack of candour about his 20-year-plus relationship with the financier and paedophile Jeffrey Epstein.
Are you embarrassed about Peter Mandelson's actions? Who's to blame for bringing him back?
Keir Starmer's anger heard behind these doors. Mandelson is a disgrace who let the country down, the cabinet was told. His threat to pass a law to strip his peerage was the final straw. Fury over a relationship between Mandelson and Epstein that others were asking about in much more depth long before Keir Starmer.
In June 2009, did you stay at the apartment in Manhattan of Jeffrey Epstein?
I'm not answering any questions about him.
He was in jail at the time for soliciting prostitution from a minor.
And my knowledge of him is something that I regret. I wish I'd never met him in the first place.
But emails released by the US government over the weekend revealed there was so much more. Payments to Mandelson's husband were thousands. There's no suggestion of wrongdoing from him. But also alleged market-sensitive intelligence passed straight to the paedophile financier within seconds of Mandelson receiving it. Condemnation from all sides.
They have made a grave, grave error of judgment, despite repeated warnings.
It's quite outrageous, and people will be quite disgusted by it.
We shouldn't have had to wait all these months before he was able to slide along very quietly and very disgracefully and resign without being sacked.
Downing Street has already handed over details of key emails to the police. Now Scotland Yard are looking at whether the law was broken.
The news that the police have launched a full-blown inquiry into Peter Mandelson will, incredibly, be welcomed in the building behind me, because they are desperate to take as tough a line as possible to insulate themselves from the massive fallout from the departure of Peter Mandelson, because the charge that these guys are facing is as toxic as they come in politics, that they took a hear no evil, see no evil approach to appointing a man who has been a fixture of the Labour family for more than four decades.
After Prime Minister's questions, the Tories could try and force the disclosure of vetting documents prepared before Mandelson's appointment, dividing Labour MPs from number 10 in the process. The embarrassment continues. Sam Coates, Sky News, Westminster.
So thanks, Sam. And so this is what's out, the very latest on this, is that there are two properties the police are now apparently searching. Extraordinary that of Mandelson's, that it's extraordinary that he would send these just as emails to me. You know, if you're actually doing any kind of serious spying in the British cabinet, you would surely be maybe writing it down on a piece of paper, handing it to leaving it at a dead letter office, doing something at least to make sure that it was difficult to trace that. But an email is the most obvious way to trace it. What that tells me is that he was confident that nobody that would ever have access to that email would dob him in, and that basically he was being protected by the by people like GCHQ and anyone else that might have access to that email, including people potentially in the Cabinet Office itself.
Well, yes, I mean, I think Mandelson probably took the view that it didn't matter because he was a charmed person, he's got all the protection.
He's above the law,
he's got what the Russians call, he's got a krisha, a roof, yeah?
Yeah.
So in other words, you know, of course, people, if you really are trying to hide things, you shouldn't be using any electronic communications at all. But of course, people routinely use electronic communications at every level of society now. And of course, that can come back to haunt you, whoever you are.
Yeah, so this whole idea that these properties are being searched, I wonder what they're actually looking for. It's a bit of a fishing operation. But Mandelson clearly believed that he was never going to be touched, and he was being protected, even back at this late stage. And as you can hear from that interview back in 2009, everybody knew about this.
Well, that's right. And of course, if you get away with it, and you know that you've got away with it, then that leads to complacency. Are you going to get away with it again?
I mean, maybe he will get away with it, because misconduct in public office is one of the most serious offences out there, actually. There are I think it's in it, misfeasance, malfeasance. So there are things you can do in public office which are accidents and mistakes which cause disasters, but they're all criminal offences still. So you have a duty of care as a public official. And malfeasance is where you're abusing your power to actually deprive the public. So that's what he's doing there. It looks on the face of it, and maybe he'll be charged and maybe he won't. But this is actually up to life in prison, this one.
Yeah. But I mean, obviously, we're focusing on Mandelson at the moment, but these files, in fact, implicate virtually the whole political elite of both the United States and Great Britain. There's a huge long list of people. And maybe they've all got to go to prison.
I think the reason we're focusing on Mandelson is because these people are in public offices of various sorts. And the last one, of course, which he resigned from recently, was this ambassador to the United States, which brings us on, I suppose, to look at and talk a bit about Morgan McSweeney, because this is what we're hearing, is that Starmer didn't actually choose to have Mandelson as the ambassador to the United States. It's one of the most important jobs of anywhere in the diplomatic or civil service, that actually McSweeney put pressure on him. And we know, don't we? Isn't it the Arlington Road Group, I think it was, which helped topple Jeremy Corbyn and put Starmer in power, that McSweeney was put in as chief of staff basically by Mandelson?
Yes, I mean, obviously Keir Starmer as the Prime Minister has to take responsibility for the decision, even if other people were pushing him in a certain direction.
Yeah, but maybe if he's pliable...
He's got to say...
Yeah, but if he's a pliable Prime Minister, this is the sort of type I think they want. A pliable Prime Minister will sign yes to whatever he's told to by his higher-ups, whether it be the King or McSweeney or Mandelson.
Well, what Starmer was chosen by the right-wing clique that now dominate the Labour leadership, because they needed to get rid of Corbyn. So he was chosen as the guy to get rid of Corbyn. And if you remember, what Starmer said is, we're going to change the vibe a bit. I haven't got a beard. My name isn't Jeremy. But of course, we're going to carry on with the same kind of socialist policies, but we're going to change the image a bit. And a lot of Labour Party members, including me, said, okay, we'll give him a go on that basis. But of course, in actual fact, it looks like from various things I've been reading that what they really wanted was Wes Streeting, who's much more to their liking in terms of being very, very neoliberal. Starmer, of course, has turned out to be a complete neoliberal. He's basically ripped up all of his promises to the Labour Party membership years ago. But Mandelson and the Blair, for example, Blair hasn't been mentioned, although, of course, Trump wants him on his board of peace and all the rest of it. But I'll bet you there's loads of stuff about Blair in these files, but we haven't seen anything about it, have we?
Hardly anything.
Because he's being
protected. You know what? If I was a producer at Newsnight or anywhere else or somewhere in the mainstream press, I'd be thinking immediately of one person to talk about this, and that is a man called Jeremy Corbyn.
Well, Corbyn has made statements about everything that
we're
talking about.
But I've seen hardly any interviews
with him. No, of course, he's been ignored, but he has in fact been out on social media saying all sorts of things.
Well, isn't it awful that former leader of the Labour Party, who was the major victim of this criminal Zionist conspiracy to destroy him, isn't... The British press are hardly interested in him at all. One person who is Katie Halper. We heard from her last week. Washington journalist who was booted out of she was sacked for asking the right questions for the public from The Hill, I think it was her newspaper. Anyway, she's got something called the Katie Halper Show. She's associated with Double Down News, and she was the one that called Jeremy Corbyn this week.
The one place where all these world leaders get to speak is now so grotesquely underfunded it cannot be effective at any level, and international law is obviously under enormous threat.
Wanted to have you react to a somewhat shocking, perhaps, comment that has gotten a lot of attention from Canada's Prime Minister Mark Carney. He made a speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos earlier this week, and let's take a listen to what he had to say.
We knew the story of the internet.
There's quite a lot of respect for Mark Carney over this side of the Atlantic, and I think what he's saying is absolutely so, that the so-called rules-based international order has always been a convenient fig leaf for the very richest and very most powerful, but it hasn't stopped them illegally going to war in Iraq, the abominable things that went on in Afghanistan. It hasn't done anything to prevent Israel occupying Gaza and the West Bank, and now the UN is either silent or incapable of doing anything about Donald Trump and Venezuela, all the threats to Cuba, to Colombia, to Mexico, and so on. So we're seeing a breakup of the rules-based order. I went over to the UN last year, UN in Geneva, for meetings with the Human Rights Council and Refugee Council and other refugee agency and others. And it was a depressing and very sad experience. Every one of their offices was short of staff, lots of empty desks. Some of the offices being moved out to cheaper places in other countries away from Geneva. All of the organizations underfunded and incapable of delivering their mandate because of the endless cuts to UN funding. So the one body and the one place where all these world leaders get to speak is now so grotesquely underfunded, it cannot be effective at any level. And international law is obviously under enormous threat. So Mark Carney is quite correct on that. What he is also interesting about is the way in which forced economic integration brings in this whole supply chain element. And indeed, Trump's national security strategy, the provision there of the so-called right of the USA to exploit natural resources, particularly in Latin America, but also Africa, is all about US supply chains to supply its industry, because so much of the natural resource of the USA have been worked out or catastrophically reduced. And that obviously creates with it a vulnerability, which Trump sees as being shored up by a military presence. And so if we continue down this road of completely ignoring international law, of accepting the Trump doctrine, of the Monroe doctrine, as well as the global doctrine, then the world essentially becomes three great military powers, the USA, China, and Russia, becomes four economic zones, that is the USA, China, Russia, and the European Union, and the NATO rift, because of Trump's demand on Greenland, isn't going to go away. And I suspect NATO may well simply break up between Europe and North America, or may well break up altogether. Now, personally, I wouldn't be sorry to see the end of military alliances, because I think they are extremely problematic in trying to promote world peace. But what it does mean is that those of us around the world that want to live in a peaceful world,
my parents
and also
are very
believe
happy
that the most important issue facing the planet, the two most important issues, are the global human inequality and the environmental disaster that is coming down the road all the time. But it's not coming down the road, it's come down the road. It's here with us. But what's happening instead is that all of the rich countries, all of them without exception, are cutting their levels of overseas aid, are opposing refugees, opposing immigration and migration into their societies, promoting a nationalist right-wing agenda, which is horrific. Look at what ICI is doing in the all over the US cities as an example of it, and spending unprecedented amounts of money on new weapons, and Trump demanding everyone spends 5% of their GDP on arms means that for most NATO countries, that will be a doubling of arms expenditure over the next few years.
So that's former Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn. I thought he was going to be talking about Epstein there. Katie Halper's just talking to you about international stuff, basically. But yeah, I mean, he's kind of has been. We've got all sorts of other people lined up to take over, potentially from Starmer. Do you think, Martin, the $64,000 question, do you think he's going to be forced out, Starmer, over this?
It's a definite possibility. I think even mainstream commentators are saying that this is possibly going to do for him. I think he might be able to survive. I think Morgan McSweeney's position is definitely vulnerable.
It seems to me as if Morgan McSweeney is essential for Starmer to stay in power. It's almost like Mandelson, the head, has been chopped off, and now you've got just the sort of torso McSweeney left, who's got its hand up the puppet, Starmer.
Yes, and I think that it doesn't look good for any of them. But the problem for the Labour Party more widely is who would take over and what direction would they take the party in? And of course, there's still a lot of, confusion about that. But I think this is looking like the kind of scandal that could lead to him being removed. The only people who can remove him, of course, are Labour MPs. And a lot of them are clearly not happy.
No, definitely not. There's lots of them briefing against him anyway. So how could that happen? Would it have to be a vote of all the MPs?
It may be a vote of the Parliamentary Labour Party to initiate a leadership challenge.
So it's The Guardian around about a year ago that exposed this group. They are called the Arlington Road Group. The headline is Starmer set up his own Labour leadership team 6 months before Corbyn's 2019 defeat. A biography has revealed how the Labour leader and his allies planned his challenge in advance of the general election. So Starmer had assembled a leadership team about 6 months before the December 2019 election. The Arlington Group began planning it in earnest how Starmer could capture the leadership from June that year, including a detailed breakdown. And they also got, this is this Labour Together group, and they got a slush fund from pro-Israel donors to the group of around about £700,000. This was Paul Holden's book, Fraud, which came out last November, exposed a lot of this. But this is really quite sickening, isn't it? The idea that before the election, Starmer has already got himself a team with Israeli money together at Arlington Road, some flat in Camden, to plan the destruction of Corbyn before the election, and also the policy of putting specific individuals, Mandelson being involved, Morgan McSweeney being involved. They'd already got their team together, ready for this government we've got now.
Yes, and of course there's loads of evidence that full-time Labour Party workers were actually actively sabotaging the electoral campaign to get Corbyn. I mean, Corbyn didn't lose by that much, but if they'd put their efforts into getting him elected, he might even have won. He would still have had a minority of the vote, but he might have had a parliamentary majority. But of course they didn't, they never wanted him, and the Israeli lobby definitely didn't want him. So they go to work behind the scenes to make sure that he doesn't get elected, and that the people they do want are then pushed forward to run the show. And of course Starmer has been pretty good from the Israeli point of view. He hasn't really criticised them. He's gone along with everything. He said that it was okay for the Israelis to starve and starve the Gazans. And that's what he said on the record. So there you go. That's him.
So the book is called Starmer, the biography. It's by Tom Baldwin, this particular one, which made these revelations. It's quite clear. From the outset, Corbyn was being undermined, and it seems likely that that was partly due to, if not largely due to, his support for Palestine.
That's right. I mean, he's obviously a thorn in the side of the establishment anyway, because a lot of what he wants to do, they don't want to happen, you know. But particularly the big issue of international affairs, you know, what could lead to World War III is what the genocide in Palestine. And of course, Jeremy Corbyn was an outspoken critic of all of those things. And therefore, you know, he's been summarily dealt with. And we've got loads of evidence to suggest that the Israelis did not sit on their hands, and they've been working very hard to prevent him from getting any kind of leverage at all.
Anyway, so the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, is wriggling like a wiggly worm right now, trying to say, well, it's actually, you know, I was the victim here. Does that wash at all, Martin?
No, I don't think that's going to work. I mean, he is saying it because he's trying to wriggle out of it, as you say. But of course, most people are going to say, well, you decided to put Mandelson in. Don't forget, the diplomatic service is a professional service, and previous, ambassadors to the US have been professional diplomats of long standing. So in other words, to send somebody who isn't a professional diplomat to be the ambassador is, in fact, you know, a break with precedent. And the idea was that Mandelson, because he was so friendly with Epstein, and because he was therefore quite close to Trump, that this would be good, because Trump and Mandelson could get on because of all these connections. Mm. But of course, that's been underpinning their faces.
They were worried about possible diplomatic links between the United States and Britain, which might reveal people like Mandelson's close links to Epstein. You know, this is what it seems to me is one of the reasons he's been put into that job, to try and cover this.
No, he was put into the job because McSweeney convinced Starmer that Mandelson would be able to get round Trump, and you know, he could flatter Trump and get him on his good side which was a very, very, you know, very debatable. I mean, you know, perhaps you shouldn't be sending people who can get on Trump's good side. Maybe you need people who can play a straight back.
I think Trump would have absolutely nothing to say to Mandelson. He'd think, who's this idiot? What's he doing here? Anyway, let's have a listen now to Sky's Beth Rigby asking Keir Starmer about this very key point, which is, can you please explain why you appointed this man that you knew was a convicted friend of a convicted paedophile and a frequent visitor to him to be the British ambassador to Washington?
Well, Beth, as I've said a number of times, I regret the decision to appoint Mandelson as ambassador. He was asked questions about the nature and extent of his relationship with Epstein, and he told lies. I had no reason at the time to know they were lies. Subsequently, I found out them to be lies. And this week, we found out way beyond the lies that we found out in September. We found out what he was up to in the aftermath of the 08 crash, when most of the government and most of the country was doing its level best to make sure people didn't lose their jobs, their livelihoods and their savings. And at that time, he chose to disclose sensitive secrets to Epstein, almost simultaneously as receiving them. And that is what I meant when I said earlier about the deceit and the standards that I stand for in public life. Yes, at the time I appointed him, I got answers from him which I believed to be true. He painted a picture of barely knowing Epstein. I didn't know that was lies at the time. I regret I didn't know. I've apologised for the fact that I appointed him in the first place, having believed those lies. Thank you, Beth. Robert.
Firstly, let me say I understand their anger and frustration.
I am angry and frustrated like them, because nobody wants to see these deceits in public life. They are angry about his association with Epstein, as am I. They're angry about what he did at the tail end of the last Labour government, and frustrated, as am I, that the full information of what was asked and answered when he was appointed can't be in the public domain. That is frustrating. As I say, I had hoped to deploy some of that at PMQs yesterday, because I wanted people to know what was said what I received. But frustrating that can't be done. So I understand their frustration, but we must remain focused on what we were elected into government to do, which is to change this country for the better for millions of people, and that's what we will do. And today, in Pride in Place, what we've done on the economy are examples, but only examples, of what we're doing. Thank you, Beth.
So it's okay because the economy is looking up, and so just forget about this. It was quite interesting to hear some sort of alarm going off in the deep background of that press conference there, and also Martin, I wonder, so if Starmer was to declare war on Russia and then to be told afterwards, oh, David Lammy lied to me, sorry about that, it's just not enough, is it, just to say sorry? Because he's clearly while most of the country, and actually much of the London media, was saying, why on earth are you doing this? This guy is totally the wrong person. It's not as if it was just McSweeney or anyone else that was advising him. The whole country and the security services were saying, no, don't do it.
Well, some people were saying, no, don't do it, and others clearly were saying, well
there's a few people who were
the guy we want.
A few people who were, a very few people who were very close to Starmer were saying it. So yeah. What we've got here is a pliable person, and he's not actually any good. Next week, do you think he'll be gone this time next week?
Well, we'll have to see how it plays out. Obviously, the next big test coming up over the horizon is the May elections in Wales and Scotland and the local elections. I think Labour MPs probably will wait to see what happens with that, although they're pretty clear that they're not going to do very well, so they could move sooner than that. This story is actually very live, yeah? It's what you really need to ask is what is going through the minds of backbench Labour MPs, because they're the ones who have to make the decision.
Well, many of them have been coming out, Richard Burgeon, saying things like this.
The question people out there are asking is, how on earth did Peter Mandelson end up
despite the warnings of so many, despite what was publicly known about the proximity of his relationship to Epstein, how on earth did he end up being appointed by the Prime Minister to the key role of Ambassador to the United States of America? It's quite incredible. What's really important is that we know exactly what happened, which resulted in Mandelson being appointed as US ambassador. So that means a paper trail. It also means knowing who pushed for it, who warned against it, and who tried to overcome those warnings. I think there really is a sickness in the heart of the culture of the Labour Party, a sickness of factionalism, where you see on the one hand in the last few weeks, Andy Burnham was blocked by the Prime Minister and by his advisers from even standing for Parliament, and yet we find out, despite all this, they paved the way for Peter Mandelson, despite his proximity to Jeffrey Epstein that was known at the time of his appointment, they paved the way and pushed him over the line into such an important position. We've seen the information that's come out, and it's truly appalling. And I think it opens up a window into the kind of relationship we've had between too many people at the top of our politics and the super rich. I think that Peter Mandelson, regardless of this, has always been known to have an unhealthy fascination with the rich, the powerful and the famous. And he's been involved in a number of scandals in his career previously of his own making, which meant that he resigned on three occasions.
Yeah, so that's Richard Burgeon, left-wing Labour MP. Yeah, I mean, there's loads. He's not leading the charge by any means, but I've seen at least half of the Labour MPs that I've seen are saying this is it. And also they want someone else potentially to lead the party during the May local elections. There's all these allegations that these elections have been cancelled primarily. The ones that have been, I think, isn't it 4 million votes or voters have been cancelled because the Labour Party has decided that there's some big changes going on. But there is another school of thought that says that Starmer will be out after May, that he'll be sitting in there basically as a kind of caretaker Prime Minister that no one really listens to much. And then when the Labour Party have a big disaster in May, then he'll be kicked out then.
Well, obviously, that was the kind of thinking that, you know, if he did badly in May, then that would persuade backbench Labour MPs that he's not a winner and they might have to remove him.
That may have happened anyway, without the Mandelson Starmer.
That's right. Because of this, it may be that people are, you've got to ask yourself what is going through the mind of Labour MPs. Burgon is a known opponent of Starmer, a known opponent, you know, so you wouldn't be, it's not surprising that he's come out with that. The real issue is what you might call Labour MPs that most people haven't heard of because they're really rather quiet.
Do you know who was selecting them? The last two general elections, who was involved in selecting them? Peter Mandelson.
Well, indeed. So
in other words, MPs.
That's right. So in other words, a lot of these MPs are a product of the Starmer system. So
the Mandelson system.
Yeah.
Or the McSweeney system.
That's right.
Yeah, so that's part of the reason why we've got where we are. And it may be that some of these people will now turn on the people that got them the job as MPs in the first place. But it's actually, I would imagine, that's one of the reasons that they want to select the MPs, people like Mandelson, is so that if anything like this happens, they can cover their backsides. Anyway, one of the people who's going to almost certainly be a contender for the leadership, particularly because he's quite polished on the press. He's running something called the National Health Service, supposedly, which is a big positive for Labour when it comes to the voters, is a guy called Wes Streeting. He could even become Prime Minister, couldn't he, fairly soon if this election takes place. So let's have a listen to what he had to say about Peter Mandelson. And does he dare broach the subject of Starmer has to go? Let's see.
I'm talking now to the Health Secretary, Wes Streeting, who is out and about this morning at a hospital, I believe. So what's the plan then? What's it going to do?
Good morning, Sophie. And not just at any hospital. I'm at the Royal Free, which saved my life when I went through kidney cancer. So as a cancer survivor myself, I could not be more proud to be launching the National Cancer Plan today.
I want to talk to you now about Lord Mandelson. He's now being investigated by the police, of course, and he's been stripped of his peerage. After the Epstein files, you know, it's all over for him now, right? But the questions are now about whether or not he should be appointed to be US ambassador in the first place. So I want to ask a really specific question on this. The Conservatives are moving a vote later about whether or not the government should just publish and be transparent with all of the information they got when it comes to the vetting process with Lord Mandelson and that appointment. Should the government publish that? Will the government publish it? And how will you be voting later?
Yes, I think the Prime Minister's going for maximum transparency here. He's obviously drawing a line that I think people will understand and agree with, which is not releasing information where it might compromise our national security and our security services, or where there may be information in there that might undermine international relations with other countries. But apart from those exceptions, the Prime Minister is going for real transparency here. And, you know, in the last few days...
MPs have told him to.
Well, hang on a second, because in the last few days, I can tell you that no one needed to tell the Prime Minister that Peter Mandelson shouldn't return to public life, shouldn't return to the House of Lords, should be stripped of his peerage, should be stripped of other titles that confer on him that status that was given to him through public service.
But now we have seen,
far from public service and national interest, self-service and self-interest, of course, all of that should go. And the Prime Minister's led on that just as...
I'm just going to come in, if I may.
The first tranche of files were released.
I'm just going to come in, if I may, because... I'll be honest, I do take slight issue with the fact that the government, you say the government has led on this. Condemning Peter Mandelson right now is easy, right? Because we've seen the latest files. What would be more difficult is ruling him out of being US ambassador at the advice of other people when we knew that he had a long-standing and continuing friendship with a convicted paedophile, when we knew that he stayed at Epstein's flat in Manhattan the year after he was sentenced to prison. And I think the thing that I am struggling with slightly is that now that all these leaked documents have come out, everyone says, oh, he's a really bad guy. We knew this guy was a paedophile, and we still allowed people who were be associated with him to be appointed to the highest office. That's not right, is it?
No, I read your piece on it, Sophie, and I think it's rightly challenging on all of this. I think that in relation to his appointment as US ambassador, he was appointed on the basis that he had considerable experience both as this country's business secretary and as the EU trade commissioner. That combined with his political experience at a sensitive time for UK-US relations and against the backdrop of global instability, it was felt that he was the right person with the right skill set. And of course, there was a vetting process and he was asked about the relationship with Epstein. Assurances were given, and I think there's a general principle people tend to abide by, which is not presuming people to be guilty by association. What the Prime Minister was clear about when the last tranche of information from the Epstein files was released was that clearly he had not been given a full and accurate picture of that association, and he was not confident that there wasn't worse to come in these files. That is why the Prime Minister sacked him rapidly. And now, of course, we know, in a way that I think people have found genuinely shocking, that as a government minister, he was also sending the most sensitive, in some cases, market-sensitive information. Now, there's a police investigation underway, as you say, and it's important that as a government minister that I don't comment on that. But I would just say, I do not need a copy of the ministerial code or a copy of the law of the land in front of me to know that what Peter Mandelson did was completely outrageous. And there is a feeling of deep betrayal here. He's betrayed two prime ministers. He's betrayed his country and our national interest. He's betrayed Epstein's victims. And of course, it's right that people ask questions about the process, his appointment sacking, and the Prime Minister will be transparent about that. I will just say one thing, though. We mustn't let Peter Mandelson off the hook in all of this. He is the person who is responsible and who is at serious fault and must now suffer the consequences of his actions both in office and since.
You went out to defend the appointment of Peter Mandelson last year in September. You said that, it was understandable that he got the job, that you're not guilty by association. How do you personally feel towards him now?
So... Sorry that got cut off there. We have the full version of that up on our show page, thisweek.org.uk later. Wes Streeting, Martin, do you think he's possibly the front runner? Lots of people are saying this, and this is what I... When they've already decided that Streeting is going to be the new Labour leader and new Prime Minister, if he was, he would be probably the first gay Prime Minister since Ted Heath, although people didn't know Ted Heath was gay at the time. That seems to be the way these things work, is that they're briefing, saying that this guy's the favourite to the journalists, who then just repeat it.
Well, I mean, you could ask the bookmakers; they'll have a view on it. I think many people on the left of the Labour Party, like me, would not be happy for him to be the Prime Minister at all. So he's got a Marmite problem.
What about this vetting business? Because he's talking quite a lot about that there, and this is obviously important. The idea is that you don't get anyone dodgy through the vetting process. Security services will have a look; they'll brief the Prime Minister. They'll be briefing McSweeney, etc. This guy is appropriate or isn't.
Yes, I mean, that is a concern, but to be honest with you, I don't trust the security services as far as I could spit. So what they say or don't say about anything should be taken with a massive shed load of salt. The reality is that Mandelson was in with the in crowd of the right wing of the Labour Party and the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and all these other people, the Epsteins, and that was his unique selling proposition.
Wes Streeting is pictured at the Bilderberg conference last year. It does seem as if the Bilderbergers like to invite people along who they believe will be ready to put in place, as a future prime minister or future leader of the opposition in almost all the NATO countries.
Yeah, well, I think Streeting was in fact the group that were behind putting Starmer in. You know, when the McSweeney group, the Arlington group that you're talking about, they wanted Wes Streeting, but Wes Streeting was regarded as too right-wing for the Labour Party membership to vote for him. Yeah, and that's generally the view of him. So Starmer was brought in as a stopgap measure because Starmer could pretend to be a more polished version of Corbyn, and that was the pitch that he made to the electorate, which is the, you know, membership of the Labour Party, trade union members and so on, is that what we're going to do is we'll carry on with the radical policies, which were obviously popular because opinion polls showed that Corbyn's actual policies were quite popular, like raising taxes on the rich. That's a no-brainer, virtually everybody agrees with that, but we've got to change the image a bit. We've got to get rid of the fusty image of the beard and all the rest of it. And that was the pitch. They knew that they couldn't sell Wes Streeting to the grassroots of the Labour Party because he was clearly too much of a Blairite. Now, of course, they're now thinking in terms of if they get rid of Starmer, we can get somebody more Blairite. But I suspect that's not going to happen because even with the denuded membership that the Labour Party now has, lots of people have left and resigned and fed up, the membership will not want a turn to the right here. They will be looking for
okay,
a turn
so
to the left.
The vetting, apparently the documents to do with the vetting are now going to be given to MPs. They've demanded to see these documents. The people in charge of that are called the Intelligence and Security Committee. They're going to do that. The chair of that committee is a chappie called Lord Beamish. He's a member of the Labour Friends of Israel.
Well, what a surprise.
So this is the way this sort of thing works, isn't it? You know, you've got your people in these important positions. I mean, it seems extraordinary to me that during a genocide, you can have the chair of the Intelligence and Security Committee, who is actually formerly part of an organisation that supports the genocidalists.
Well, that's right. I mean, as George Galloway pointed out, why don't we have Friends of Uzbekistan? Labour Friends of Zimbabwe, Labour Friends of Brazil. But no, we've got a whole organisation called Labour. What about Labour Friends of Palestine? No, but if you want to get ahead in the Labour Party, you've got to be a friend of Israel. And of course, that's because people like Trevor Chin, who's a big businessman in this country, but he's given loads of money both to Tory and Labour.
Well, he was one of the funders of the Arlington Group. To the tune of hundreds of thousands of pounds.
There you are.
So this is the way it's done, folks. And what about Wes Streeting? Will you be happy to see him take over from Starmer if that happens?
From my point of view, as a member of the Labour Party, I don't want him to be the Prime Minister.
Why not?
He's too right-wing. He's actually, what he's involved with is the privatisation of the health service. That's what he's doing. He's put more money into the health service, but it's got to be reformed. And what he means by that is that Palantir have got to take over the whole of the data set, and we're going to move towards basically an insurance-based system, which is what the Americans have wanted for the National Health Service since 1944.
Well, of course, Reform UK are rubbing their hands watching all this going on, and Zia Yusuf was on BBC's Question Time last night and was asked about what he thought about Keir Starmer's decision to appoint Mandelson to the US ambassador role.
Let's be clear about Keir Starmer. The only reason he is the Prime Minister, the reason he won the general election, is because the Tory vote collapsed, because the British public had finally had enough of their betrayal and their corruption. Keir Starmer's entire offering to the British electorate was simply that he would not be corrupt and sleazy like the Tories. And what have we seen since then? An unholy fire hose of corruption and sleaze, one scandal after another. It started with Lord Ali. Do you remember him? One of Labour's biggest donors, who got it passed, no less, to number 10 Downing Street. Then it turned out Keir Starmer had somehow forgotten to declare that he and his wife had received thousands of pounds of donations in the form of designer clothes and even designer spectacles and hospitality from Lord Ali. Then he put one of his donors in a cushy job in the Treasury without telling anyone that he was a donor. He's managed to find time to cancel elections for millions of people, drive farmers to suicide, and withdraw the right to jury trial from British people. And now we find out, by the way, I think the questions so far have been incisive, but I don't think quite do justice to what Keir Starmer's admitted that he knew. Keir Starmer in Parliament admitted that he knew that Peter Mandelson continued his disgusting friendship with Jeffrey Epstein even after Epstein had become a convicted paedophile. Now we know that Mandelson received tens of thousands of dollars at least from Jeffrey Epstein, probably more, but that's what we all know already. And what do we also know? He leaked information about the half a trillion euro bailout and Gordon Brown's resignation before the public knew anything about it. And get this too, get this, because I don't know how much time people watching this program have spent looking at the appalling things on the Justice Department's website. But on the day that Jeffrey Epstein was released from prison for having been in jail for paedophilia, he received an email from Peter Mandelson saying, and I quote, "Liberation Day." Keir Starmer chose to ignore the advice of security services and make this man Britain's ambassador to the United States. Yes, for sure, Peter Mandelson almost certainly deserves to be in jail, but the buck stops with the executive. Keir Starmer is a disgrace to his office and should resign.
Zia, what do you make of the fact that Nigel Farage said of Mandelson when he was appointed, he's a very clever man, he'll be respected because he has a big brain, and that he'd be willing to help Mandelson negotiate with the Trump administration?
Well, the thing Nigel also said at the time, a multitude of times, that given Nigel's close relationship with the President of the United States, he offered himself to be
sure, but we're talking about Mandelson tonight, Zia. The point is that what was known about Mandelson in terms of the fact that he had stayed at the house of a convicted paedophile while he was in prison, that was in the public domain. Nonetheless, Nigel Farage seemed to think his appointment wasn't too bad.
Yeah, look, I understand that line of questioning, and I think it's a reasonable one. But I would say this. If you're the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, you have at your disposal the entire apparatus of state of this country, including our security services.
But the key factor for Epstein was known.
That's why I say the buck stops with the executive. Nigel Farage is not the Prime Minister. Nigel Farage is not the person who appointed Peter Mandelson to be this country's ambassador to the United States of America, in defiance of advice, by the way, from security services, as has been widely reported. So I'm afraid we've got to go back to the original question, which is, should Keir Starmer resign? If you have at your disposal the entire security services and you choose to ignore them and put your buddy and somebody who has frankly been, you know, almost the embodiment of sleaze in this country. His nickname was literally the Prince of Darkness. That was literally his nickname. Anyone in this audience who would have hired people or done an interview, if you found out a candidate was widely reputed to be known as the Prince of Darkness, he'd probably ask a few more questions. So I'm afraid trying to divert responsibility away from the Prime Minister of this country, who is the executive and who appointed him, I think is misguided.
Sure. I'm not trying to say that anyone else is responsible. I'm simply pointing out what was said about his appointment at the time.
Yes, so that's Zia Yusuf from Reform on last week's BBC Question Time. And I think it's pretty clear, isn't it, that Farage was behind the appointment. He's saying positive noises at the time. Always easy for people to come out afterwards and make comments like, oh, well, we never really liked him. We always knew he was a dodgy, dodgy character. So I think Fiona Bruce, for a change, her producer in her ear or whatever, did quite a good job there in putting that onto Zia Yusuf. But, I mean, he's quite right that there's been this litany of errors. The whole British political system, it seems to me, is being discredited here. These appointments are signed off by the King. The King has been completely, like, exonerated here. Andrew is the one that's getting all the flack. But King Charles isn't being criticised at all. Anyway, what did you make of Reform's criticisms there?
Well, he made a competent job of making his points. But, of course, Fiona Bruce did point out that Nigel Farage seemed to be quite happy about Mandelson being the ambassador when he was first appointed, because he saw him as, you know, because he saw, you know, basically, Mandelson was one of us. And
this is part of the problem,
you know?
Isn't it? Everyone goes along with the groupthink until they see a chink in the armour, and then they get in there with their crowbar, which is what Reform are now doing. Why didn't they get in there with their crowbar? The other problem with all of this, of course, is the Intelligence and Security Committee that were doing the vetting. Maybe they were actually trying to help Mandelson take this job. So maybe some of those should go.
Well, that's right. I mean, Mandelson obviously is the flavour of the moment, and that's what we're talking about, and he's going to be, you know, he's into deep doo-doo. But it isn't just about Mandelson. The Epstein files, the whole thing, is actually an indictment of the whole
Western
system.
Martin, we can talk about that later. We're focusing right now on the future of the cabinet and the government, whether the government can ride this one out. And I think they probably will try to. That Starmer will probably try to carry on, but nobody will really be listening to him anymore from what he said. And one of the reasons we're here in a minute. But I thought before we finish on Mandelson, Starmer, and the fallout here in the UK from the exposing what appear on the surface of it to be the crimes of Peter Mandelson, the misconduct in public office, most importantly, and the basically leaking to the Israelis, the Mossad, to Epstein, to Ghislaine Maxwell, secrets from within the British cabinet. I mean, this is spying, and very, very serious. Official Secrets Act stuff possibly might kick in if the Intelligence and Security Committee do their job and the police are allowed to do their job. But Patrizia has penned something on this week. The gloves are off. She calls it scams, slams, shams and hams. The gloves are off, Starmer's out. Behind the scenes, Rothschilds, no doubt. Mossad wires exposed to kill. The swamp is full of lies and swill. Mandy's fall, Starmer's lies. A den of hoodlums we despise. Epstein's sty, full of snouts. Wriggle, wriggle, call them out. Gaza's thread connects it all. So many deaths on each and all. Who turned their faces, compromised, lied and lied. And lied and lied. The new regime already signed. Chubby Wes and Dancy primed. Handler, many behind closed doors. Decisions made as acts of war. Rainer, tame. Her never will. A gay and chav, a double bill. Please appease the public game. They really think we're all inane. McSweeney, keen. He, snide, behind. Israel pro, we know the kind. The scam behind. Oh, Jeremy. Donations hid from all. Tee-hee. A game of chess, a game of lies. Our lives a joke in all their eyes. McSweeney out is now the call. Big shot, hot shot, watch him fall. Judas roams with many faces. Watch Morgan booted out of places. Epstein's gang of thieves and cranks on sloppy governments have banked. Money, drugs, sex, booze and fags on high life ne'er-do-wells have dragged. No winners we who fund these tools. The time has come to out the ghouls. Well, let's just hope we can replace the ghouls with something a little bit better. That's not at all in any way guaranteed. There was also on Question Time last night from the New Statesman, which is a left-wing, am I right, Martin? A left-wing little newspaper?
Vaguely.
It is. I mean, isn't it sort of like The Spectator is for the Tories and the New Statesman is for the Labour Party? Anyway, he was very, very critical of Starmer and also, of course, of Peter Mandelson in the Epstein files. And we'll wind up with this clip from Ollie Dugmore, the New Statesman, on Question Time last night.
Should Keir Starmer go? That's basically it.
Yeah, that's the question. Look, I'm generally a pretty forgiving person. I think our politics is poorer for its lack of empathy. I think most people should not be defined by the worst thing that they've ever done in their lives. And most people deserve a second chance. I do, however, have some moral boundaries. And one of them is that I think it is wrong to have sex with children. And I wouldn't want to be friends with anyone that did that. And I certainly wouldn't want to work with them. If I did, I think you'd all be asking me questions and they'd be valid ones. That is apparently now a fringe position for some people at the top of the Labour Party, which is an extraordinary thing to be able to say. I don't know about you. I don't know any paedophiles. I don't know anyone that's run a global sex trafficking ring. Like, these are extraordinary things that we're talking about here. And not only that, and I should be clear, like, that there's some brilliant journalism that my colleagues at the New Statesman have done over the last couple of days. Our political editor, Alva Ray, has reported that not only did the people at the top of the Labour Party know about this, and that's because this information was available on Google. They don't need the security services to tell them it.
When you say this, because there's a whole slew of information coming out, but I think you're referring specifically to the fact that there were photographs of Mandelson's
with Epstein, friendship with Epstein,
and the fact that he stayed in his house
Whilst he was in prison. And they didn't think that that was disqualifying. They thought, actually, this is our guy. This is our guy that we're going to elevate to the most prestigious diplomatic posting that we have. We're going to make him our man in Washington. And not only that, we're going to bring him back to London every so often to advise us on cabinet reshuffles. And actually, when we're choosing our candidates for the 2024 general election, we're going to let him input on that too, because we think he's a great judge of character. Like, come on. I just add, you know, Keir Starmer promised a few things when he was trying to become Prime Minister. You may remember the Labour Party manifesto had one word on the front. Just said change. He made a really big deal about standards in public life. Really big deal of it. And fair play, right, after the sort of moral atrocities of austerity, the COVID contracts, the way that the Tories ran the country. You can understand why he did that. If you're going to stand on the steps of Downing Street and promise that to the British people and then do this, what does that say about you? What does that say about you?
That's Ollie Dugmore from the New Statesman there, speaking on BBC's Question Time last night. Refreshing voice, almost like sort of common sense from outside the political bubble, just saying what everyone is thinking. Well, why on earth would Mandelson be friends with this guy? And why would we want anyone like that anywhere near British public life? I suppose the idea over the years has been boiling the frog to somehow, Martin, over the years, make this kind of thing supposedly normal.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think somebody like him is likely to be somebody who finds it quite difficult to criticise the Labour government because they support the Labour government. So when people like him are speaking out in that way, that does suggest that Starmer's position and McSweeney's position is very vulnerable. Because, I mean, Richard Bergen, who we heard from earlier, is a malcontent. So, you know, that's the sort of thing he would say. This guy is, you know, more of a worry from the Prime Minister's point of view.
And so I think also we need to we're going to be after the break coming back to look at some of the international aspects of the Epstein scandal, so maybe even moving away a little bit from Starmer and Mandelson, Martin. I'm sure you'll be happy about that. But we've had this week the latest hearing here in Bristol on a subject which I was really actually chuffed to see yesterday. We had Sangeeta Lal from ITN, and we also had Sky News in Bristol County Court yesterday to keep an eye on this case, which is going on about what they call van dwellers in Bristol. That is caravan dwellers, travellers basically, living up on the downs. Now, just to give a bit of context, what we've seen since COVID is some serious, like massive evictions basically, going on around the city over the last 3 years or so from discrete sites out of the way, mostly on public land where people have been living in caravans and vehicles and self-managing those sites. So around about 200, 250 people have been slowly evicted, and of course they've ended up by curbside, by the side of the road. And we're now finding out that these sites where they were evicted from, the council is putting big bits of fencing around them and saying, well, you can go back to where you were last year. And it's only a year since people were evicted from the gasworks site in Lockleys, but you're going to be paying £3,600 a year for the pleasure. That is a rent and a £2,000 council tax as of April. So there's a lot of unhappiness in the city as to what, I mean, this is something that people have been doing for centuries, living in vans and vehicles. Martin, the Gypsy and the Travellers were persecuted by the Nazis. And it looks as if they're saying, well, we're not going to have any more of that in Bristol. Everyone has got to pay.
Well, obviously, I'm not as au fait with this as you are, Tony, but, I mean, this has been an ongoing struggle because, as you know, we've got a huge housing crisis here in Bristol.
It's almost like Bristol's a sort of test case as to, well, we've got lots of people living in vans and vehicles as part of the housing crisis. Bristol is finding a way to corral them in these compounds and charge them.
Well, if that's what the council's trying to do, that's what they're trying to do. I mean,
these are people with no money. Yes, just a lot of these people are there because they don't have any money.
Well, indeed, but of course, you know, many people. I'm sad to say,
is this part of Rachel Reeves' push for growth, economic growth?
No, the problem is that lots of people who vote in elections in Bristol, they tend to be homeowners who vote. And people being pushed off the downs are being pushed off the downs by locals, residents who live in the posh houses around the downs, and they don't want them there. Now, I'm not saying that they're right. I don't agree with them, but that's one of the problems.
The reason that people have been on the downs is because these other sites have been being evicted to make way for these council compounds. So anyway, it's just, I think, interesting to see that we've got really, a possible confrontation coming between these, and because the council are getting their way in the court. So let's have a listen now to the PM programme yesterday on Radio 4, which came to Bristol to have a pretty good and close look at what is happening. Of course, they miss out so much. They miss out the fact that these evictions have been taking place over the last few years, and that's why we have so many people on the streets. They miss that out completely. And this idea that the council are trying to arrange for the people that used to be able to be on those sites, self-managed sites for free, are now going to be told, you know, you have to pay the £3,600 a year just to stay there.
Now, PM is in Bristol today. Whenever we broadcast from outside London, we look for local stories that might throw light on issues of national importance. And often it turns out those stories ultimately come down to housing. And here in this city, where housing is short and rents are high, they are dealing with the challenge of hundreds of people who are living in vans and caravans. In fact, they're creating special locations for van dwellers called meanwhile sites on wasteland or building land that's just waiting for development. I went out this morning to take a look at the issue of van dwelling, meeting first Hannah Miller, political reporter at BBC Bristol.
So we're on the Downs in Bristol. It is the biggest patch of green land across the whole of the city, owned by the people of Bristol, and really somewhere that is kind of at the heart of the city. Also, I think worth saying, one of the wealthiest areas.
£1 million houses.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then along the road at the side, we have, I don't know, maybe 24 caravans and vans just parked up. What we should say, though, is the council do not think this is a place where they want residents in vans and caravans. They are trying to clear this area. And what are they doing?
And they started back in COVID trying to create these meanwhile sites. But
what is a meanwhile site? It's a strange
name. A meanwhile site is a derelict piece of land, so probably going to be used for housing, but there's a whole planning process to go through. So they say, rather than having it derelict, doing nothing, put some water in there, put some toilet facilities, make sure there's a bin collection. People pay, I think it's about £30 a week plus about £30 a week council tax, but there's a waiting list for those sites.
So, walking across the green space here to the road at the edge, where we have a row of caravans and vans, I think we can talk to this gentleman in one of the vans here. Can you show me around? I mean, it's tight, but you've got, I can see, facilities here. So this is where you cook?
Yes, yeah, so I've got a little cooking area and...
The bed at the back?
Bed and storage under the bed. Got bathroom facilities, little port-a-loo, yeah, so...
Where's that? Where's the port-a-loo?
In there.
In there? How long have you been living here?
6 years.
Most people don't live in vans or caravans, and I guess they'll ask, why? What brought you into... to this form
well,
of accommodation?
Money, really. And work dropped off at one time, and I didn't have enough to pay the rent. And, well, I was actually converting a Luton removals van, and I thought, well, I could move into that, and I haven't really been able to afford anywhere since. Yeah.
Tell me about the people living along this road, then. I mean, because we've spoken to someone who's working. I don't know if you're working. Some people are there... going off to work in the morning, coming back in the evening. Yeah.
Yeah, some people are trying to save up enough money to find somewhere that they can live.
You're not working, or you
no, no.
If the council said to you, look, we've got a one-bedroom flat, we can put you in that, you'll be paying rent, you have to go and get a job, and it's going to be a sort of more conventional lifestyle.
You don't sound very attractive.
It doesn't sound attractive.
It's the rat race. Part of why I'm in a van is because I don't want to be in a rat race.
So that's the first of the two clips we've got from the PM programme visiting Bristol to look at the travellers' situation. Is he right, Martin, to say he's had enough of the rat race?
Well, I mean, people are going to have various reasons for doing what they're doing. I mean, others
will say, well, the rat race, I'm in it, so why shouldn't you be?
Well, that's right. So, in other words, this is a social tension. People who've bought their houses and done very well for themselves up in Clifton, they're not that keen to have loads of people in vans on their turf as they see it. And this is, you know, and of course they've all made those people a lot of money from their house prices rising over the last 30, 40 years. And of course that's what priced everybody else out. So there we go.
Well, one of the great joys of being part of Bristol Housing Action, which is called BAM for short, which has been around since the 1970s here in Bristol, is that you really do get to see what people really think, and particularly those poor that have no lawyers. And of course now, since 2012, the legal aid system was broken down, Martin. It's very, very difficult for people who are living in a caravan with no money to actually get any legal representation in court at all. As we found yesterday, nobody could turn up. And another reason is that they're worried that they might even get hit with costs. So they just don't come to court. And it was a sort of surreal, it's been a surreal set of hearings in Bristol County Court, where it's just the plaintiffs and there have been really no defendants at all appearing.
Well, that's possibly quite rational from the point of view of the defendants, as they're just trying to keep a low profile and get on with what they're doing.
Yeah, well, the numbers on the Downs have gone down a little bit. But anyway, let's now have a listen to Flora Sidebottom, who's one of the people on the Travellers, group of Travellers that's been sending information into the council about what the Travellers want. It doesn't look as if the council are taking very much notice of it at all. There's also the fact that the Downs has traditionally always been managed for 100 years or so by something called the Downs Committee, but that has merchant venturers on it. The merchant venturers I mentioned at the beginning of the program is this slave trading organization that exploited North America for several centuries, and then apparently now they're a bunch of wonderful philanthropists, but you can't scrutinize them. They're constituted under a royal charter. They sit up on the promenade on the Downs, as they always have done, it seems, in Bristol. And it's their land, but they don't want these discussions to be taking place in public on the Downs Committee. So they've decided that the City Council is going to be dealing with this particular one. So the answer is to create these meanwhile sites. That's what they're calling them. The council has evicted travellers from these sites, and now it's saying you can go back and it's going to be a meanwhile site. You're going to have to pay and we're going to manage it.
Hi, my name is Flora. I'm a youth worker, an artist and a community organiser.
And
I've lived in my vehicle for the last 6 years. I'm very lucky. I've got a heat source. The community that I live with, we didn't have a tap for a year. So all of the drivers in the community would fetch water for the non-drivers, for instance.
I want to talk about the meanwhile sites. Now, tell me about those and how attractive they are to people living in vans and caravans.
I think that they are a step in the right direction, and it's amazing that the council is providing something. However, there's been reports of issues with unclean water, vermin problems, contaminated land, a lack of access, and you have no postal address.
There's a darker side to the life in caravans and vans, which is tensions with people in the community. Just talk to me about what's been happening.
Thanks, I'm glad you asked that question. I've personally heard reports of arson threats, tyre slashing, beeping of horns late at night, racial slurs used against people. It can be a somewhat hostile climate right now.
Who's doing it? What are they trying to do? What?
I don't fully understand it either. I think they're trying to make people feel unwelcome.
I want you to think about it from the other side. How much of a public nuisance, if I'm living in a house and I've got vehicle dwellers near me, how much of a nuisance is that to me in the house?
I think this is entirely dependent on the individuals living in that community. Quite often the actions of one problematic person in a huge collective can mean that the whole group of people are tarnished with the same brush. Mm. I would actually say that the majority of park-ups are safe, quiet, thoughtful, respectful. I certainly know that my own community takes extra precaution to act in such a way not to disrupt local residents.
So this is what we call a meanwhile site. So we're standing on the old gasworks, actually. You can see I'm Councillor Barry Parsons. I'm a local councillor here in Bristol, and I'm chair of the city's Homes and Housing Delivery Committee.
It's all flooded here at the moment.
one of them is, yeah. There's a kind of a sort of circular pond right in the middle of it. But there's also an area of hard standing just over there and another one just over there. This is earmarked for housing.
And we should say we're just at the back of a residential road.
That's right, yeah. We're looking to use places like this to provide some pitches with some just really basic facilities, clean water, rubbish, toilets, where they can sort of have somewhere that's a secure base where they can plan their next move.
Let's go over and look at this site, because it is a bit of what you probably call wasteland at the moment. How many pitches are you going to get here?
So on this site, there's going to be 19.
Obviously, Bristol seems to have more of an issue with van and caravan dwelling than other cities in the UK.
Yeah, and one of the reasons for that, thanks Barry Parsons, is because we have a festival scene down here. A lot of people are living in vehicles. But also, of course, we've got a housing crisis, Martin. Now, he's talking there about 90 pitches on that site, which originally had 50 caravans and vehicles on it. So the council, what they're doing is they're clearing out people out and cramming them in, basically, into their own new sites. This is something which the Mayor, George Ferguson, I spoke to over Christmas about this, and he was saying, well, they were trying to do it when I was mayor. I wouldn't have it because, you know, the idea is that, yes, you should have spaces for people to live like this out of the way, particularly if it's public land. And it's that they were on quite good sites. So these evictions were particularly pernicious in that the council is premeditatedly making these people homeless curbside on in front of people's houses, etc., in order to cajole them and coerce them into starting to pay at least £100 a week or so to live in the city.
Well, Mayor Ferguson, obviously, is no longer in charge. And, of course, we've now got a green council and, you know, in theory, they should be, you know, taking into account all the various interests involved.
This is a policy which was begun under Marvin, the Labour mayor. The Greens have just said, oh, we're going to go along with it. And, of course, the merchant venturers are powerful enough in the city to just cajole the whole thing along. I think also there's a problem, as we were talking about when the Greens were first elected, as happened in Brighton, that they're just not used to power. And so the senior council officers and powerful interests like landowners and merchant venturers in the city are just running rings around the Green councillors.
Well, that you may say that, but I'm not a member of the Green Party or a member of the council. They'd have to defend their own position. It's you know, the real problem is the housing crisis. I mean, you know, the level of rents in Bristol is the second highest in the country outside London. And, you know, we've got a huge homelessness problem. We've got loads of people sleeping on the streets, people sofa surfing, other people in vans. And it's a huge problem for ordinary people.
Yeah, so, I mean, actually, what's happening is the van dwellers, caravan dwellers, travellers, are really showing the way in many ways. They're saying, well, look, if you just simply cannot pay the rent and you're getting totally stressed out by on 0 hours contracts or various sorts of hassle at work, and you can just get yourself a van and start to relax a bit. And this is one of the things that comes across hearing Flora there, is that you have much more time when you don't have massive amounts of rent or mortgage to pay.
Well, if you think about it, the reason why people go to food banks is because they can't pay the rent. It's not because they can't afford food. They probably could afford food. They can't afford the rent, and you've got to pay the rent, otherwise you lose your housing.
So which is more important, eating or having a roof over your head?
Well, we're on February the 5th, Tony, and I don't want to sleep outside. I don't know about you. You know, you could probably last several days without eating, but you might die straight away in the freezing cold, mightn't you?
Yes, you might well do that. So that's an ongoing thing. We will be reporting on that, of course, keeping track on what's happening with the 800 or so caravan, van dwellers and travellers in Bristol here. And for many, many, many people around the country are looking at Bristol as an organisation or a city that's trying to deal with this problem. But what they're doing is very similar to what they happen with the people living on boats in the city centre, is just saying, well, if you're not going to pay a decent amount of money, and of course they're £35 a week rent they're charging for these little pitches, all you get for it is basically a waste disposal, which they used to get on the old traveller sites anyway, and you'll get a water supply. And we hear this week that up in Lochlea's, the site that the council have provided for the travellers, the water there is contaminated, and they're having to bring in bottled water onto the site. So why should they be paying council tax for this? It just sounds like the idea is that even people with no money and no proper accommodation, they will still have to pay if they want to be in the sun. We don't want people thinking that if you can't pay the rent, you've got another option.
Well, that's right. I mean, the struggle, this is a constant struggle about who controls physical space, who gets the right to do whatever they want to do in other people. And, of course, it's not as if everybody's necessarily on the same side about this. Some people want certain things to happen, other people don't want
to happen. It's true. What you say is quite insightful, because many of the van dwellers are pro the meanwhile sites. Quite a lot of them who can afford the rent are saying, well, this is quite good. I've got an income and I can pay this. Some of them will be on benefits as well, which will almost certainly be paying for those sites. But there is probably an equal number of them that say, no, we just want to do what travellers have always done, and use bits of spare land to live. We don't have the permanency that other people have, but travellers have been doing this for thousands of years, so why shouldn't we? Anyway, not on to the next, just before the break, final story before the break. As I mentioned right at the start, this guy, Reverend Paul Williamson, he made rather a noise last week in St Paul's Cathedral as it was announced that Sarah Mullally was going to be the next Archbishop of Canterbury. And because he was shouting out his objections, not interrupting anybody, he pointed out to me, and you're about to hear, it was because he was concerned that she was not appropriate, and a little bit like Epstein or something, I suppose, that she had skeletons in her closet, that an important fact that meant that she was not appropriate to be Archbishop of Canterbury, who's in charge of safeguarding. But first of all, I want to hear from him what actually happened to him on the day when he actually turned up to make his objections at St Paul's Cathedral last week.
It's the fourth-rate management of a banana republic in terminal decline. Mm. It's a cross between the Mafia and the Vatican at its historically worst. It is not pastors looking after people, preaching Jesus Christ and setting an example.
Well, this is the role of the church as a whole, is to bring people to Christ.
Well, this is why everybody's walking out. They're sick and tired of it. They voted with their feet, they voted with their wallet. They don't want what's on the menu. And the menu seems to be woke and all sorts of other things. People don't go to church for that. They go for spiritual nourishment. It's been in the press. Somebody went to a funeral. They expected to hear about the resurrection of Jesus Christ and our hope of eternal life. They got a sermon on slavery. It's got nothing to do with why people have gone to that service. And this is typical. I was interviewed on the steps of St. Paul's afterwards by the BBC. And Aleem Makbul was most courteous and considerate. And his young lady assistant, Catherine, and I were chatting. And she said, when I joined the religious department, I thought I'd be hearing a lot about religion because I'm interested. And she said, but nearly all the clergy we've interviewed, it's like talking to faded politicians or out-of-work social workers.
What happened in church
that,
then?
Because that tells you everything.
You explained that you were not allowed to make your objection. And I think,
no,
am I right in saying
out.
you were ejected? How did they do that?
Yes. They had two people sitting behind me. One beside or behind each pillar on the right-hand side of the aisle. And as I said, I waited most courteously for a gap in speaking where it mentioned objections before I stood up. So I did not interrupt anybody speaking, and I did not heckle, because that's to interrupt a speaker. I did not. I stood up and corrected the lie when they said there are no objections. So I got shouted at from behind by a chap with a beard, black hair, black beard, modest build, youngish, and told to shut up and sit down or keep silence or something, which I did not. I finished my very brief statement, which I've already repeated to you. And then I already had my walking stick and my bag in my hand, and I turned to go out because I had no intention of disrupting the third part of the proceedings, which was a return to a church service. I was pushed down the aisle by the chap with the beard, and I said, I can't walk any faster. I've got a walking stick. I've actually got a steel leg. We got to the door, and he was quite huffy with me. And I managed at that point to stop long enough to place the shoulder bag over my shoulder. I went through the revolving door to the top of the steps. And I felt this hand in the small of my back pushing me down the steps. I got pushed down one step. I put my walking stick on the next lower step and said, I can't do this. I've got a walking stick. Stop it. I can't remember what else I said. But I said about the walking stick. And I grabbed the handrail on the left. I was terrified. The steps at St. Paul's are like a precipice of granite. I could have been badly injured or even killed. Then an older security guard helped me down the steps. It's an absolute disgrace what was done.
Well, that's Reverend Paul Williamson, who was objecting to the appointment of Sarah Mullally as the new Archbishop of Canterbury, speaking to me earlier this week. I mean, it does sound a little bit like the sort of security that you'd expect at a nightclub rather than St. Paul's Cathedral.
Well, obviously, I don't know what exactly happened in the incident, and he's given his account of what occurred. So we've heard what he's
had
to
say. So you're not surprised? You're not surprised then?
Well, I mean, if you go to a church service and you... I mean, there is, as he said, I mean, he didn't interrupt anybody or whatever, but some people are going to take that amiss, aren't they? They've come for the service. They don't necessarily want to hear him objecting.
Okay, well, the thing is, he'd finished what he was saying. He'd made an objection. He said that there are several safeguarding issues with Sarah Mullally mm-hmm. that I would like to raise at this point, because I think it's inappropriate of her to be the Archbishop. And then they've decided, right, we're going to now eject him, even though he's actually finished what he's saying. Now, this sounds to me as if it's not a church. This is just some sort of little bunch of gangsters.
Well, I mean, you could say that. I mean, I didn't see the incident. No
certainly
doubt the person with the
England.
Beard who pushed him might have a different account of what occurred.
Well, it's just typical, isn't it, to have, and he said, explained an older person who was doing the security, who's obviously been in the church a little bit longer before it became satanic or whatever, you know, something evil is going on there. You don't push somebody, you don't push a vicar down the stairs. What on earth is that about? Maybe he's lying, but certainly it's a perfectly, if you have a look at the film of him being pushed up the aisle, you know, let the guy walk. If he's going out, just leave him to walk. You don't need to push him in the small of the back. So anyway, this is in a way, is a sort of human side of the objections that that he was making as part of that little appearance. And as he explains to me in the longer interview, he's already tried to make these problems with Sarah Mullally known to the church authorities, but they're not interested. They don't want to hear. So here it is. This is Reverend Paul Williamson again explaining why it is that Sarah Mullally is not appropriate to be Archbishop of Canterbury.
She was Chief Nursing Officer of the National Health Service. Her job specification included safeguarding lead for the whole of the National Health Service. So she cannot claim she knew nothing about safeguarding. It was her job. She comes to be Bishop of London and she discovers there is a man called Martin Sargent who kept 42 files of foul and filthy tittle-tattle lies, inventions about the sexual misdemeanors of clergy. They were on her desk for 2 years. She has admitted that in a voice recording which has been made public. So she did nothing, having been told by the Archdeacon of London that there were sexual problems. So you could have had paedophiles and sexual perverts running around London for 2 years. She did nothing. She then took the file on the Reverend Alan Griffin and passed it on to all the officials of the diocese and safeguarding people and to a third party. It stated very clearly that he had had rent boys. I will come back to that. It also revealed he was HIV positive and had made 2 attempts at suicide. His private medical records are not to be given to anybody under the law of GDPR, which she broke. She then also stated, we believe, that he was under police investigation. All of this is listed by Mary Hassell, the King's coroner, in her excoriating report to Archbishop Welby called A Notice for the Prevention of Future Death. She lists those 3 things that Sarah Mullally did and said that Alan Griffin, I quote, he could not cope, and then he committed suicide. She cross-examined Martin Sargent, who admitted that the rent boys incident was made up by him. So Sarah Mullally passed on a lie condemning somebody, broke the law on medical records, and then suggested that he was under police investigation. He was vulnerable, that is proven from his medical records. And he could not cope, he committed suicide. Who then is accountable? And the only answer by the coroner is Sarah Mullally. There is then a thing called the Chris Robson report examining what went on. It's 47 pages long. In the first 7 pages, he states that he is not allowed to say anybody is guilty. I contacted him personally, and he told me he was fed up, in despair, couldn't believe it, that he'd been told he may not say who is responsible for the suicide. So we come back to St. Paul's. I set all of this out with the coroner's report, Chris Robson's report, and all sorts of other legal documents before Timothy Bryden on the 23rd. On the 27th, I was effectively trashed and written out, you're too late to bring these objections, by that sleight of hand, that deceit, that fraud. So I stood up and said it.
So that's why he stood up and what he was saying. I will publish what I can on the website at thisweek.org.uk of these documents to do with the problems with safeguarding that have taken place. But it does seem, Martin, as I said right at the very start of the show, that sometimes you do wonder whether people are put forward for these jobs because they have dirt on them of some sort. And Sarah Mullally should know better. It sounds as if there's been a cover-up over this lack of safeguarding that she's been doing with these various people in the past.
Well, I mean, these are all very specific allegations.
Why won't the church listen to them? Because they don't want, obviously, what they've told him, no, you're too late to give these allegations or give these this report. It's not just allegations, it's a full report and some many facts too, to us. And then when he says, tries at the actual announcement itself to say, what about these problems with safeguarding, he is just literally pushed at the top of the stairs of the St Paul's out. So they're not interested in listening, are they?
Well, I don't know enough about the allegations.
Well, he's told you quite a lot there.
Yes. Right?
I'm sure you were listening.
Yes.
So this is about whether, you know, the right thing to do is to listen to the allegations.
Yes, and of course the other thing to do, if we were the BBC, you'd have to go to Sarah Mullally and say, well, he says this, what do you say? We haven't heard from her.
Well, they've kept it all out of there, haven't they?
Well, okay, but the problem
she will have nothing to say, I can guarantee
well, exactly.
it.
Okay, well, the point is that if you go to find an investigation,
point of this process is that Sarah Mullally will not have to say anything about this. She will not be asked about it because it doesn't exist as an allegation apart from on this show. All he's managed to do is stand up in St Paul's and talk about the allegations, and nobody else seems to know about them.
Well, I don't know enough about the allegations to know who knows about them. So I'm just listening to what you're saying
and
listening
to what he's saying. It's not so much allegations as a report, which will be very interesting to hear. Anyway, we'll be going back to Epstein International after the break. Now the crippled riseth from the bed in rain.
Thank you. Was a roll. Oh, can't anybody see? We've got a war to fight. Never found a way. Regardless of what they say, how can we feel this wrong? From this moment, how can it feel this wrong? Storm in the moonlight, I feel no more can stay. Frozen to myself, I got nobody on my side. Surely that ain't right. Surely that ain't right. Oh, can't anybody see? We've got a war to fight. Never found a way. Regardless of what they say, how can I feel this wrong?
It's a bit naughty interrupting me, yeah. And that's a big audience, a live audience for Portishead there speaking or singing back in September last year at quite a big concert in the Wembley Arena. I think they call it something else now, the Ovo Awful Useless Rubbish Energy Arena. because they are really an absolutely appalling, rubbishy company. And so anyway, so that, yeah, so that was the song was called Roads, I think it's called, from the 1994 album, but sung there last year by Portishead, and the album was called Dummy, but the big concert was called Together for Palestine, and that was on 17th of September 2025. So what I'll do is I'll put a link also up to, on our show page, to the full concert. All sorts of interesting good stuff in there. Before that we heard Papa Was a Rolling Stone. Now, I think the original was The Temptations. That was a group which I had to use their version because they're called Rare Earth, which is something that we're hearing quite a lot about nowadays. But that was recorded back in 1971. Papa Was a Rolling Stone, their version. And before that, we heard Now the Green Blade Riseth. So that's a hymn, a rather nice one. And in a way, sort of, I suppose we're thinking here about renewal as we come towards Easter. So welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers sipping his tea there. Is that tea you're sipping, Martin? And me, Tony Gosling, plunging back into the Epstein revelations. Great to see all this information coming out and the secrecy of government. I remember there was a brilliant book by Jim Keith I read many years ago called Rule by Secrecy. This is really how it works, isn't it? So if a government has got proper freedom of information and journalists are doing their job, then the secrecy and the wickedness and the corruption within government can't hide.
In theory. But of course, as we all know, there are various ways to get things done.
How?
Well, I mean, you either don't have any information given at all, which is quite common around the world, or they say they're going to give you the information, but they don't give it you, which is also quite common. Which, and of course, they also lie.
It may well happen with this vetting thing, with the Intelligence and Security Committee giving a whole bunch of nonsense, which is, oh, we looked into this and we found nothing, but actually, of course, it was true, we now know. So the intelligence people are very, very good, aren't they, at saying that this is what we know, and actually they know completely different. So they're very, really are sort of consciousness and I suppose mind control people, really. This is what you are allowed to know and this is what you're not.
Well, I mean, the basic job description of being an intelligence agency is to deceive. And of course, the way we've got our politicians saying, well, the intelligence services said this and this and this, as if that was absolutely the final word on it. In actual fact, they're as venal as anybody else.
We're going back to the sort of idea of Watergate, really, here, where you've got the intelligence services who, both internal, the FBI in the States and the CIA externally, that their job is to serve the national interests and the public. But actually, suddenly, if they've been doing something they shouldn't be, like Iran-Contra or whatever, then they suddenly start to abuse their power and they start to interfere with the with government, burgling political party offices, this sort of thing. And this same thing that happened with Watergate and Richard Nixon, who, by the way, the real reason for Watergate, it seems to me, was to do with Richard Nixon demanding that the assassination files on John F. Kennedy were being released. That's Laurent Guillenot dug that one out, for example. And we had a very similar thing in Britain, didn't we, with Harold Wilson, with the intelligence services and the army deciding, right, actually, we're in charge. So really, although Britain comes across as a democracy and likes to think about it, it's really more like Pakistan with the military rule.
Well, I mean, Pakistan used to be part of the British Empire, and all the administrative structures in Pakistan were created by the British. The fact is that the British state has always been an imperialist state with an imperialist agenda, and the politicians are, you know, essentially just the face for all of that, and they still are.
Okay, who's the worst journalist in Britain, do you think?
I think Tony Gosling.
Oh, come on, thank you. See, oh, Martin, how Dave, stop laughing. Is someone called, I think, called Andrew Marr. We're about to hear from him now.
Let me begin tonight with something that I think is even more important, even more extraordinary. Growing suspicions of a Russian connection. Epstein had apparently limitless supplies of money. Where did it come from? He procured many young Russian girls. Why was that so easy for him? The files released show more than 1,000 documents which referred to Vladimir Putin and 9,000 referring to Moscow. The FBI says that he was Putin's wealth manager. Epstein filed all of his messages. He filmed and taped powerful Western leaders in deeply compromising situations. Why? Doesn't it make you wonder at least about the possibility of a KGB operation big enough to ensnare former presidents and prime ministers and the leaders of some of the world's most powerful companies? I know, this all sounds impossibly sensational, conspiratorial, a James Bond villain plot in real life. But there is so much smoke billowing out of one of the most extraordinary establishment crises in my lifetime that it is well worth exploring whether there might be also a genuinely ominous backstory.
Well, that is massive misdirection, is the first thing you point out. And of course, he referred to the KGB there. The KGB was abolished in 1991. So whatever was going on here, the current FSB is not the KGB. It's called the FSB for a reason. Okay. So in other words, it's a simple point. Why are you calling it the KGB when it isn't called the KGB anymore? That's because people have heard of the KGB. If you said it was an FSB, people go, what's the FSB? KGB, he knows, it's like pressing a button. Yeah, so it sounds like a James Bond
film. Is it aimed at older people that remember the KGB?
Well, that's right. This is the point. But the point is...
What is he up to?
Well, what's happening here is everybody knows that Epstein was a Mossad agent. He was Jewish. He's got loads of Jewish and Israeli friends, including Ehud Barak, who used to be the prime minister of Israel and spent loads of times with him. And he's got some, because he hung around in the international world of finance and spying, he probably did run into a few Russians. But that doesn't mean that he was working for the Russians. All the evidence, and in fact, anybody can look this up on the internet, is that he was working for Mossad. And that their blackmail was not by the KGB, it was by Mossad on people like Mandelson, on people like Trump, on people like anybody in any position of power, so that they could carry out the Oded Yinon plan to destabilize the Middle East and genocide the Palestinians. That is what we're not hearing in the mainstream. That's what all mainstream outlets should be covering. Mossad. The Israelis have basically been blackmailing, and they were the ones who were responsible for abuse of these young girls.
Well, we do know this, and journalists around the world will know this. Ari Ben Manasseh is based in Canada now. He's a former Israeli Mossad officer who was the controller for Robert Maxwell, and he's been very open about this. One of the best I would thoroughly recommend, I think it's nearly 2 hours long, all in all, a documentary all about this is called, it came out in 2021, called Epstein's Shadow, Ghislaine Maxwell. And of course, the whole story seems to me, Martin, is actually about the Maxwell family working for the Mossad. Epstein, as from relatively humble beginnings, was brought into this to be the sort of front person for it. And Ghislaine Maxwell, of course, is still alive.
Yeah. And of course, all the evidence, as you said, points to Epstein working for Mossad. So why is Andrew Marr suddenly saying, but was it the case that he was working for Putin?
Maybe Andrew Marr is working for Mossad. Anyway, let's have a listen now to an extract from Epstein's Shadow, this 2021 documentary. And I'll put a link up to the full documentary video on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. Ari Ben Manasseh is the sort of key witness here, as he's on the inside, ex-Mossad officer.
The mystery is growing on the whereabouts of the British socialite who allegedly helped Epstein recruit young girls.
Where in the world is Ghislaine Maxwell?
She has tremendous resources and access all over the world.
Once Jeffrey was dead, Ghislaine Maxwell disappears. She disappears off all radar.
Reporters all over the country try to find her. That added to a little bit of her mystique.
Where is Ghislaine Maxwell?
Nobody knows where Maxwell is.
When I was asked, would they ever find her? I joked, I was like, she's probably in a submarine somewhere.
The world's media has not found this woman yet. This woman's just disappeared off the face of the earth, and she's key to all of this.
If you're Ghislaine Maxwell, I think her reaction was a logical one. Oh my God, he's dead. I have to protect myself.
You know, evidence hasn't really emerged of, like, what exactly did the NYPD pick up when they raided his house. Was there blackmail tapes there? If it's bona fide stuff, it's possible fortunes would be lost. It would be really disastrous.
I think Jeffrey Epstein was a sexual deviant going after young girls, and if a couple of powerful men got caught up in the snare, well, jackpot.
When he walked into the New York mansion to Palm Beach, everything was being filmed. Government officials, the politicians, the royalty, they were taping everybody.
Do you think people knew they were being taped?
No.
No.
I do not. Not at all.
Maybe Ghislaine Maxwell knows where all those photographs and tapes and videos are.
So the $64,000 question here is, where are the tapes?
If they contain what we think they do, to say that they would be explosive would be the understatement of the day.
The dominant Epstein conspiracy theory is that he was videotaping all these high-profile people as blackmail. And the other side of that theory is maybe he was doing this on behalf of the CIA or intelligence agencies and got recruited to spy for them. That's sort of the theory that ties it all together in terms of the videotaping and mysterious sort of high-profile connections, in terms of his ridiculous treatment by law enforcement in Palm Beach. And it does a pretty neat and tidy job.
Those videos could be used as blackmail, as compromising material on foreign dignitaries, on people in power. I have no doubt someone would have been interested in that kind of information.
I obviously have no idea what transpired with Epstein's video surveillance cameras. But on Maxwell's side, there's her father, Robert Maxwell. He was for sure involved with intelligence, probably both KGB and Mossad.
The Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency.
Will he ask the Prime Minister to order an immediate inquiry into the alleged relationship between the Israeli intelligence service and Robert Maxwell?
The allegations about Maxwell's close connections with Israel were first made in a book by Seymour Hersh.
The man had an awful lot of information about an awful lot of things and did an awful lot that we don't know very much about.
One of the main sources of that book, Ari Ben-Menashe, a former Israeli intelligence officer, claimed that Maxwell had played a major role in smuggling arms for Israel.
Robert Maxwell was working for Israeli intelligence. He was an operative for quite a long time. He was a senior operative, as a matter of fact. I was working with him. I was sort of supervising what he was doing for us.
One of the things that I learned early on at the CIA, and this is certainly consistent in other intelligence organizations, is that they're often multi-generational. You want people in the same family because they know that you're loyal. Let's just say for the sake of argument that this was the Israelis that were involved, and Ghislaine Maxwell's father already had a relationship with the Israeli services. Ghislaine was important and well-connected and working at a higher level of society than most anybody else. So I don't think it's at all a leap in logic to think she's continuing to do daddy's work.
Epstein started working with Israeli intelligence as well. Selling or giving or collecting secrets, however you want to put it. Yes, that's right. They were collecting secrets for the Israelis.
It would be impossible for me to know the details of any sort of like government conspiracy, but there's enough there that I think something's going on.
This is such a bigger animal than anyone knows, and Ghislaine Maxwell has the answers, and until she talks, we may never know.
Absolute cracker of a documentary, really, really good. Of course, they should be repeating that. Of course, they won't. It's called Epstein's Shadow, Ghislaine Maxwell, spelt Ghislaine, came out in 2021. That's Ari Ben-Menashe, Martin, saying he was the controller for, or one of the supervisors for, the Mossad and Israeli intelligence for Robert Maxwell. He's saying, oh, most definitely Ghislaine and Jeffrey were working for them.
Well, that's right. I mean, you'd have thought that somebody like Andrew Marr, he's got access to the internet like everybody else. It should be, everybody should be talking about the Israeli connection, Israeli connection, Israeli connection.
Maybe unless,
but we're
he's,
not. Apparently
unless
he's, it's the
he's,
Russians.
Unless his job at LBC depends, maybe when he was at the BBC too, on being a cheerleader for Israel.
Well, that's right, and or just playing interference, as they would say in American football, just distracting people. Which this should be a moment where everybody considers what power the Israeli state has got in Britain and the United States. Instead, we're being given a lot of gossip about bad behaviour with children, and also people pointing the finger and saying there's all the Russians behind all of this. It's an insult to the intelligence of people who are paying attention.
Well, on Double Down News, Lowkey's done an awesome piece this week entitled Epstein's Darkest Secret. It, again, putting forward lots and lots of very hard evidence about the links between Ghislaine Maxwell's little sting operation in Palm Beach in New York on Epstein Island and the Israeli Mossad as an intelligence sting. And but I think we'll take another slightly sideways look at this, because, well, you know, it's obvious why RT is banned now, because they're putting out all sorts of interesting things that they're finding in the Epstein files, and one of them is the links between Jeffrey Epstein and this guy called Viktor Pinchuk. No one seems to have heard much about him, but he is the mastermind of the coup, apparently, over in Ukraine. He was one of the people who was a top Freemason. He's a master of one of the big lodges in Kiev, but he was more importantly a very powerful oligarch, is what they call them, philanthropist, what you might call them, but an extremely wealthy man who had accrued lots of non-political power, but he was using it for political ends. And he's supposed by many to be the person who's actually the sort of general organizer of the Maidan coup, Martin. But we haven't heard anything about that side of the release. So this is why I think it's important that we are able to hear RT, don't you?
Yes, I mean, the reason they've banned RT, and I obviously haven't been on it, I used to be on it regularly, they've banned it because RT is a responsible competition for the Western media. I mean, they're going through the files just as everybody else is, and of course they're picking stuff up which the Western media isn't picking up, because they don't want people do rely upon journalists to go through these files for them, because they haven't got the time themselves. And if RT was available on Freeview, people could just flick over and see what the Russians were saying, and then they could flick over and see what the British were saying.
The links between the Epstein operation and what's been going on in Ukraine with this war, I think, are fascinating.
Convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein and his vast network had ambitious plans with links and ties stretching all across the globe. The now deceased financier was actively interested in Ukrainian politics, according to the latest release, especially during periods of unrest and revolution. RT's Shea Bowes has been unraveling Epstein's footprints on the Ukraine issue.
It seems there were few places Epstein's influence didn't reach, even into the Ukrainian elites, just like super wealthy oligarch Viktor Pinchuk. Here's an email from Bill Gates' chief science advisor, Boris Nikolich, to the paedophile financier, extending Pinchuk's invitation for Epstein to attend the elite WEF meeting in Davos.
I guess you would recommend me to attend? Too many Ukrainians will be there. I do think that you should attend Davos. I agree there is a lot of wasted time and JOs there, but there are some interesting meetings, people as well.
But who exactly is Viktor Pinchuk? Well, he's a super-rich Ukrainian oligarch and the son-in-law of former Ukrainian president Leonid Kuchma. We're told he made his billions in the pipe-making industry, but for years his real passion has been promoting Ukraine's integration into the EU. In 2006, he consolidated these activities into the Viktor Pinchuk Foundation, which became Ukraine's largest private philanthropic foundation, collaborating with Soros, Clinton, and of course Tony Blair. And in 2014, he enthusiastically supported the Maidan coup.
It's not about people making a choice in favor of a specific political deal. It's about the fact that free citizens have developed their own opinion and are talking about it. Nothing could be stronger. This gives me great optimism about the future of our country. the people of Ukraine have learnt from the mistakes that followed the Orange Revolution of 2004, where initial hopes of a free and democratic Ukraine founded in recrimination and corruption. Today, civil society has proved itself to be much stronger. Now the spotlight is on politicians and big business, who must prove they can match the maturity demonstrated by ordinary Ukrainians and that they are prepared to put their country first, ahead of their own interests.
Now, when we say enthusiastically supported Ukraine's bloody Maidan, the head of the country's security services at the time says Pinchuk actually funded it.
Poroshenko, Firtash and Pinchuk financed the Maidan. They are hostages of this situation because their entire business and all their assets allocated abroad, and they followed the commands of the West. They had no choice but to support the Maidan, as otherwise they would have been left without their assets. In this case, they weren't thinking about the country. They were only thinking about their finances.
Now, unsurprisingly, Pinchuk's connections with Western high society don't only involve polite conversation. The relationship was also financial. The Ukrainian billionaire was, for example, one of the largest donors to the Clinton Foundation. In 2008, Pinchuk made a five-year, $29 million commitment to the Clinton Global Initiative. In 2009 and 2013, right before Maidan, and while Hillary Clinton was actually U.S. Secretary of State, the Clinton Foundation received at least $8.6 million from the Pinchuk Foundation.
The Pinchuk Foundation said its donations were intended to help to make Ukraine a successful, free, modern country based on European values. It said that if Mr. Pinchuk was lobbying the State Department about Ukraine, this cannot be seen as anything but a good thing.
Now, surprise, surprise, Pinchuk has bankrolled several high-profile Westerners and their trips to Ukraine. In April 2023, ex-CIA director Mike Pompeo took a big fat check for $300,000 from Pinchuk for a whirlwind 24-hour visit, during which he even met with Vladimir Zelensky, and he also gave a speech.
It may be that the outcome is a weaker Russia, but that is not the objective. Now, the objective is to create Ukrainian sovereignty and to protect it. With a second objective, one that matters to you and to the United States of America, is that the security arrangement, the architecture for security in the aftermath of this, gets us another 70 years, right, without a major land warfare in Europe.
Now, the head of the opposition, Other Ukraine Movement, and the former leader of the opposition, Viktor Medvedchuk, has named Pinchuk as one of Zelensky's biggest backers and most powerful donors.
The main sponsors of Zelensky's criminal regime are Akhmetov, Firtash, Pinchuk, and others who have benefited and enriched themselves by killing hundreds of thousands of people over the course of the war.
Of course, in May 2019, Zelensky won the presidential election. And just months before Epstein's death, Epstein texted Larry Summers, former United States Secretary of the Treasury, that he needed advice on Ukraine and that Zelensky was looking for help. Summers also revealed that he was connected to guess who? You got it, Viktor Pinchuk.
So, yeah, so that's RT. That's what we're hearing on RT, which is giving you a bit of insight into what the connections with the Epstein operation, the Mossad, and their role in the Maidan coup as well. I mean, this guy, Viktor Pinchuk, is hardly mentioned, but he's extremely powerful. He's a bit like, I suppose, a Ukraine's version of Berezovsky.
Yes, I mean, obviously the Russians have got their own perspective on this. I mean, they're going through the files and they're finding things of interest to them. But of course, you know, meanwhile, we've got Andrew Marr, who probably is the worst journalist in Britain, as you said.
Worse than me.
Yes, worse than you.
You do love me, Alfred.
I was reading somewhere this week that if you see a headline with a question mark at the end of it, in any media, the answer to the question is no. So when it says, did Epstein have connections with the KGB, question mark, the answer is no.
And if it has quote marks in it, that you know that it's actually probably not a true quote.
That's right.
So there are all sorts
There are ways where you can tell.
We were told that Soviet Russia was like this when we were growing up. That you had to read between the lines the whole time and not believe a word they were telling you.
The other thing people notice about is passive construction. So that Palestinians died today. Not that they were killed by the Israelis, they just died. But we don't know who killed them. And yet, you see, you can see all these tricks that there are in media for steering the emotions of the people that were being exposed to whatever it is.
Now, what about Jeffrey Epstein's link to the Rothschilds family? Because that's another Jewish influence network based in the City of London and actually in other capitals around Europe.
Well, his pad in New York, he bought from Lynn Forrester de Rothschild. And, of course, these people are at the top of the chain in terms of both pro-Israeli stuff and also just loads and loads of money. And, you know, as you can imagine, there's a quite small group of people who actually run things, probably in the several thousands, and they all know each other, and, you know, that's who's really in charge.
Well, we're about to find out if they're immune to prosecution. What do you think?
Well, I think so. What's going to happen is they're doing the very best they can to settle. Look, what happened at Nuremberg, certain Nazis were hung. Others
hanged,
were just and others were taken into the NATO infrastructure as senior officers. So I imagine that what will happen now is this whole process will be used to get rid of various people that are surplus to requirements. Perhaps Epstein himself, for example, who clearly did not commit suicide. He was either murdered or he's escaped. And, you know, the ordinary public are inevitably just nonplussed by all of this because there's so much going on and they can easily be bamboozled unless they know all the detail, which they're not going to get.
Alan Dershowitz said he was introduced to Jeffrey Epstein by Lynn Forrester de Rothschild. In fact, she was a bit of an introducer. Apparently met her current husband at Epstein's place. But anyway, let's have a listen now to a piece. Some people in the United States have broached this topic because, of course, there are quite a few of these Epstein leaks which mention the Rothschild family, particularly Lynn Forrester de Rothschild. So here is Really Graceful, which is a YouTube channel in the States taking a look at and going through the Rothschild leaks from the Epstein files.
Hey, internet friends, stare into the abyss with me for a moment. On January 30th, the Department of Justice uploaded over 3 million pages, 2,000 videos, and 180,000 images associated with the Epstein files. There's so much to cover. I'm going to have to do a series of shorter videos just to get through all of it so it's not lost in one video. Let's first address the Rothschild connection to Epstein. Just to remind everybody, Jeffrey Epstein was convicted in 2008, but he continued to associate with powerful people. He wasn't shunned from any social circles. They straight up did not care. It just really seems like Epstein was an upper manager of the three-city empire, the unholy trinity. The city of London, with Israel as its proxy fourth pillar. Washington, D.C., and the Vatican, a.k.a. the bank, the muscle, and the spirit, or the ideological control. That's my thesis for all of these videos I'm about to make, a statement which we will revisit at the end of all of them. Obviously, if we're talking about the bank first, we're talking about the Rothschilds. In a 2016 email to Palantir billionaire Peter Thiel, Epstein begins the email with, "As you probably know, I represent the Rothschilds. I was hoping to figure out a way for the bank that has $160 billion in management can do something in tech. Best client list in the world. Prehistoric products. It can wait. Good luck in China." End of the email. I do wonder what prehistoric products Epstein is referring to. He then proceeds to invite Thiel to his island. I've done several videos on the Rothschild family and their deep links to world banking as one of the hidden hand families controlling the world, but when you say that online, you get hit with a little blue bubble bar under your video saying that it's all conspiracy theory. Meanwhile, Jeffrey Epstein is just leading his email with it. It's his hook.
I've never met Peter Thiel, and everybody says he sort of jumps around and acts really strange, like he's on drugs.
Smoking, yeah.
However, he has a company called Palantir.
Bigger than Sequoia or Klein of
Perkins. These are the new Klein of Perkins. Everybody, these are the smart boys. Mm-hmm.
That same year, Arian Dave Rothschild, who married into the Rothschild family, who serves as CEO of the Edmond de Rothschild Group, which is a Swiss private bank, she met with Epstein from 2013 to 2019. and they established a $25 million consulting agreement, which was signed in October of 2015, between Epstein Southern Trust Company and the Rothschild Group for risk analysis and algorithm-related services. So the Rothschilds, on paper for this contract, were paying him $25 million just to provide introductions to U.S. finance leaders and law firms, and he provided tax and risk consulting while also helping Arion personally on a couple of occasions with advice on estate management. Guys, they went to Broadway shows together, Canadian vacations, discussed, you know, destroying the world together. I'll provide you the proof on that here in just a second, but leaked by a hacker group and uploaded by a nonprofit whistleblower, distributed denial of secrets, the inbox of Israeli Defense Minister Ehud Barak showed a close relationship with Epstein, showcasing Epstein's efforts to leverage his personal friendship with Arion to raise funds for the development of Israeli cyber weapons. It's crazy that this guy was this close with a former prime minister of a country. These particular emails were from 2013 to 2016, when Brock used Epstein as a consultant and financial advisor.
So that's, just cut that a little bit short. I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Really graceful, she calls herself. But isn't it interesting, if you just put Rothschild into the search of these latest Epstein files released, you find things like conversations, audio tapes and things like that in there. But in some ways, more importantly, it's quite, there's quite obviously a very close relationship. And it looks as if Jeffrey Epstein was getting tens of millions of in funding, not from doing some sort of amazing deals on the New York Stock Exchange, but directly from the Rothschild Bank.
That's right. And, of course, you know, we're only scratching the surface here of what's really going on. There's going to be an awful lot of flim-flam to stop people getting to the grips with what really went on, because it goes to the top in our country, in the United States, and in Israel.
Do you want to say something about the Rothschilds' role over the years? Because they are, I mean, you know, on the surface of it anyway, they're just another bank in the City of London next door to the Bank of England.
Well, I mean, obviously there's more than one Rothschild, but they tend to work as a clan, you know.
Aren't they in sort of, I think, isn't it, something like Milan and Paris?
Well, they've been around for quite a long time.
They have sort of, they've got different parts of the family in different capitals and cities around Europe.
Well, that's right. I mean, nobody can deny that they are a very powerful banking dynasty. I mean, they don't deny it. And of course, they're very pro-Israel by and large. Not all of them.
Well, Walter Rothschild wrote the Balfour Declaration.
Well, indeed, that's right. So, in other words, these people are at the top of the food chain, along with people like Sheldon Adelson's Miriam Adelson and Pinchuk, and so on. They're very wealthy. Pinchuk is also Jewish. And they're connected to the Israeli state. And they, of course, are very powerful. They run a lot of things. They run a lot of legal things and a lot of illegal things. And, of course, they are also supporters of genocide, as we all know.
Do you know anything about this lady that seemed to be the closest, really, to Epstein, the French banker Arion de Rothschild? And apparently there's lots and lots of discussion about all these connections in the French press at the moment.
Well, obviously, you know, unless you're following it in detail, you're not going to know everything about everything. I mean, but of course, you know, but this is an opportunity for everybody to, you know, get interested and try and work out what's really going on.
So banking is surely, it's in a way in competition with democracy and with the voters, isn't it? So the bankers want one thing, which is control, and the voters are actually fighting a losing battle to control what goes on in their countries.
Well, the voters are very low down the food chain, and they're only given certain choices anyway, even if they bother to vote. And of course, in many countries they can vote, but they don't. I mean, a large part of the US electorate doesn't even bother to turn out. Well, I mean, it's always been the way, if you know anything about history, the wealthy, powerful dynasties, you know, they tend to, you know, the Plantagenets, the Rothschilds, whoever they are, they tend to run the show because that's what they want to do, and they've got the wherewithal to do it.
So what we found out through this latest leak is this the Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and Arion de Rothschild were linked through a network of business and political dealings brokered through Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell. So they they are, what they're doing is, it seems to me, putting individuals together, that whether it's with finance and also political influence, to make sure that certain people have the money to do whatever it is they want to do. In this case, it's Ehud Barak.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, money talks, we all know. And, but, you know, money is power and power is money. It's, the two things are very closely linked.
And, of course, in the background to all of this, we've got the threats against Iran from Trump at the moment. What do you make of them, Martin? I mean, we talked a little bit about this last week, but I mean, is there going to be an attack? I always get worried when I see that there are negotiations which are taking place in Oman, I think, isn't it, at the moment, at Muscat, between the Americans and the Iranians about their nuclear program, supposedly. That they're going to have some negotiations, as they did in Qatar with the Israelis, and suddenly they're attacked actually in the middle of negotiations. So, what do you make of threats against Iran at the moment?
Well, obviously we're following this closely because, of course, if there is an attack on Iran, it could actually lead to a major, major world crisis. The consequences could be absolutely mind-boggling. So, you know, obviously everybody's looking at this, what's going to happen here? I think they are getting cold feet because the Iranians are making it clear, if we're attacked, we are going to fight back this time and we're not going to pull our punches, and you know that we can hurt you. So maybe you need to think on.
But does that really worry, do you think, these financial chiefs around the world? Aren't they kind of waiting for some sort of conflict, and maybe they can make money out of it?
Well, this is an imponderable question, because it may well be. I mean, look at the run up to the First World War. It wasn't actually anybody's plan. It just happened because everybody stuck to what they thought they were doing, and they didn't really understand the consequences. This is the real danger of the world we live in, is that it won't be a plan by anybody. Somebody will just do one stupid thing, and it creates a systematic failure through running through the financial systems and all the on political systems and so on. And then we're all, we're all going over Niagara Falls without a paddle.
Well, last week we had the David Feldman from the New York branch of Neturi Carter, the Orthodox Jewish anti-Zionist church, well, sort of synagogues, basically. And this week I thought we'd have a look at London. What are the Neturi Carter in London saying? One of the best programmes I find out there at the moment. And he's having some... He even had me on as a guest. That's how crazy they are. Or out there. And it's Mohsin Abbas, Said Mohsin Abbas, based in London. And he has got a series of programmes at the moment that he's doing on his YouTube channel and elsewhere called The Deep Dive Perspective. I don't know if you've been following those, Martin. At all. But anyway, here he is this week talking to two of the rabbis from London, Neturi Carter, about this whole idea of prospect of war between Israel and Iran and the United States threats against Iran.
First of all, we saw by the riots, there's many, many Zionist flags. Sometimes even there was more flags, Zionist flags, than the Iranian Shah flags.
Well, let me come on to Rabbi Ben, because that's given me an interesting set of facts.
Just let me finish to talk
please,
about
please,
this.
Yeah, please, and then
about,
we'll come on. I'm ignoring Rabbi Beck here at the moment.
Clearly known that all these weapons that have been used to murder civilians, they killed thousands of more the rioters, these terrorists that had the guns. They killed about 500 police officers. They burned mosques, they burned ambulances, businesses, private houses, schools, police stations. They killed innocent police officers that didn't do anything to them. The instructions were very clear from the Zionist Mossad. You spread chaos and anarchism in Iran.
I see.
And then we'll come and finish the job. But you have, in order to make chaos in the streets, the government will not be functioned. There'll be no more government that will be responsible for peace and for order, for security. That was the aim. I never saw people that rose with weapons and burned ambulances and masks because of the currency is very weak. There is a way how to protest about a weak currency and a weak economy.
Yeah.
People can go to the street peacefully. You can see that it was amazing, orchestrated by the Zionist Mossad, that provided arms, munition, and bombs and drones in order to what it has, it will be a preface for a revolution against a legal elected government.
Well, Ravik, clearly, we've talked about Judaism and its stance on the way Jews should be living. Is what Benjamin Netanyahu or Smotrich doing in terms of their policy towards Iran, particularly, i.e. interfering with the sovereignty of another nation, pushing the superpower in the world, the US, to also unleash its weapons, is that something from a Jewish spiritual religious perspective that you can condone?
100% had nothing to do with the Jewish religion. They transformed completely Judaism, taking that out of context completely, and transformed Judaism into a nationalism movement. Mm. And this caused all of this. I mean, the Jewish religion is already an old religion of 3,500 years. We are already 2,000 years in exile, and you never heard a Jewish people try to take over other countries and blah, 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 like that. Jewish people, since God sent us into exile, is staying in exile as loyal citizens to all the countries all over the world. Mm. They have no any national aspirations in something like that. All of that, what has been done, this is completely a part of the transformation from Judaism, from a religion to a national movement, emptying out from the holiness of the religion, from the believing God. What this automatically means, living peacefully with all your neighbors and with everybody, and not to rebel against them, and completely bring them in completely a different world.
So that's a couple of rabbis from Neturi Karta in London speaking on the Deep Dive Perspective with Saeed Mohsin Abbas this week, Martin. There, it doesn't seem as if this version of Orthodox Judaism gets any hearing at all, actually, in the mass media in Britain.
No, it's interesting to hear, isn't it? Because obviously people have various views about what they think Judaism is, and as you know, there's quite a strong strand of Judaism which rejects Zionism as blasphemous.
Well, actually, the BBC rejects Zionism as blasphemous. They tell their presenters and their journalists and their correspondents never to use the word.
Well, that's because they're trying to avoid the negative connotations that it's now associated with. I don't think you can generalise about people. Some Jewish people are absolutely appalled by what the State of Israel is doing. There's plenty of them here in Bristol. And I'm not Jewish, but if I was, I'd be disgusted with what they're doing, because they're dragging my good name through the mud.
Well, it may be a fake, but one of the Epstein leaks from someone called James Haywood, H-E-Y-W-O-O-D, sent in 2018. I mean, it looks as if it may possibly be a joke, this, but it says, off-grid re-intro potential angel investment opportunity in brackets nuclear. We need to discuss World War III. The investors want to know if we're still planning. This is to Jeffrey Epstein from James Haywood. Planning to use the date February the 8th, 2026. So that's Sunday. So is World War III going to start on Sunday? Do you think the Americans will attack Iran?
Well, if they do attack Iran, it could start. That's why we're hoping that they don't.
How do you see it developing if something does kick off? Well, not just this week, but however, because the Iranians are clearly going to want to target the American forces in the Middle East and Israel.
Well, that's right. And the Israelis have got nuclear weapons. So one of the things they might do, if they're feeling really, really threatened, is the Samson option, where they simply nuke Iran. And, of course, Sheldon Adelson called for exactly that. He said, we need to turn Iran into a parking lot. And, of course, his wife is the biggest funder of Trump's political campaigns.
There are a couple of other stories this week. There's loads of stuff always going on. But, I mean, particularly important, not covered much at all in the Western press, is the end of the START treaty, the Nuclear Forces Treaty. Apparently there's now no limits on the amount of nuclear weapons that NATO or the Russians can develop.
Well, that's right. And the Russians have been, because all these treaties have been ripped up by the West. And of course, Donald Trump ripped up the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty. The ABM Treaty was cancelled by Bush. And of course, we developed these treaties in the 1980s and 1990s, and the whole world breathed a sigh of relief because we've actually got some mechanism for controlling nuclear weapons, and for, and very importantly, both sides could check the other side's nuclear arsenals. So, for example, all strategic bombers had to be kept out in the open so that satellites could see them. And that, of course, allowed the Ukrainians, probably supported by the British, to attack those nuclear bombers, which were out in the open because of the treaty. Yeah. Now, and that's very, very naughty of the Ukrainians, because the Russians are then going to conclude, well, we can't keep our bombers out in the open where they can be looked at, because you're going to try and blow them up.
And Trump is saying today, no new START treaty.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Americans have been against any kind of treaty. They're the ones
who ripped them all up. It's funny, because when he was running for president, he said he wanted denuclearisation, didn't he?
Yeah, but he wants denuclearisation on his terms. In other words, the Russians to give up all their nuclear weapons and us to keep ours. So that's what he means by that.
And also, Benjamin Netanyahu today has released his conditions for regime change in Iran. Ahead of US-Iran talks, Netanyahu tells the cabinet conditions could lead to regime change in Tehran. The day before US and Iranian officials are set to hold talks in Amman, Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu convened a meeting of his security cabinet, told his top official that certain conditions are in place that may lead to the downfall of the Iranian government. Times of Israel reported that Netanyahu conveyed the same message he delivered during a Knesset committee meeting, where he said there is a build-up of conditions towards a critical mass that could bring about the downfall of the Iranian regime, though he also reportedly said he was unsure if those conditions would be sufficient to topple the government. Netanyahu also told the Knesset committee that the coordination between America and Israel as high and close as possible.
Well, I mean, the whole point of all of this is to try and change the regime in Iran. There's no real there's no real problem with nuclear weapons. They haven't been developing them. And of course, and even if they were to start negotiating about that, the Israelis and the Western elites do not want the Iranian regime at all. They just don't want it there. So the Iranians have actually bent over backwards to try and talk nicely and to negotiate. I mean, that is their strategy, you know, that is their way. They've agreed to meet in Amman, for example. Originally, they wanted to meet in Abu Dhabi, and they said, no, you've got to be in Amman because that's more neutral. And the Americans were saying, well, we want to discuss your ballistic missile and we want to discuss your support for Hezbollah and Nasrallah. And they said, well, we're not discussing that at all. If you want to talk to us about nuclear weapons, we will talk to you, but we're not talking about anything else because it's none of your business.
Okay, well, that seems to make sense. I wonder if anything will happen. We shall see. And it seems bizarre, doesn't it, that when everyone is just thinking about peace, there is a faction out there that is thinking, right, this is the start, let's start a war and use those peace talks as the springboard for the war. Very perverse, very upside down. Anyway, also on RT this week, Sergei Lavrov has been talking about the Ukraine peace plan and explaining whether he thinks that there's really any chance. Before we hear from him, Martin, do you think there's any chance of peace in Ukraine?
No.
Another round of military talks between Russia and Ukraine is getting underway. American representatives will be there, Witkoff, Kushner, and just yesterday, of all places in Britain, the Financial Times runs a story saying that Russia is about to be handed something close to an ultimatum, a document on security guarantees for Ukraine already agreed upon. Now, these security guarantees would mean that if Russia ever dares to attack Ukraine again, or if they, the clever ones, cook up some false flag provocation to pin on Russia, then within 24 hours, they condemn it and give Ukraine the green light to keep fighting. Within 48 hours, they rally everyone willing to join the war. And within 72 hours, the United States steps in. This is absurd, but it's a very telling kind of absurd. What does it mean? For the past year, the West, Europe especially, kept saying one thing. We need reliable security guarantees, an immediate ceasefire and security guarantees. We asked them, if you're not solving the underlying issues, won't these guarantees just mean that any ceasefire gets used to pump more weapons into Ukraine? They didn't hear the logic, didn't respond to it at all. But now, under the current circumstances, when the Trump administration started engaging with the Ukraine in question, by the way, the Trump administration's approach to Russia is seen in very mixed terms here. We have some romantic, some people prone to wishful thinking. I can say a few words about that later, but for now, back to Ukraine. The Trump administration did decide to address the root causes of the conflict.
Worried about what? What are you worried about with the Trump administration?
I can come back to that, but let me finish on security guarantees. From the start, they said they wanted to deal with root causes. President Trump publicly told Kiev to forget about NATO membership. He and his team started talking about recognizing realities on the ground. All of this was discussed in Alaska, and once again, we explained to our American counterparts that for us, it's not really about territory, not about land. What matters most is the people who live there, whose ancestors lived there. For centuries, these lands were settled by Russian people who spoke Russian, who raised their children in Russian. And these people in Crimea, in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, as well as in the so-called Little Russia, in Kherson and the Zaporozhye regions, were labeled as subhuman by the putschists who came to power as a result of a coup d'etat. The then President Poroshenko openly told them to their faces, our children, Ukrainian children, will go to clean kindergartens, to spacious, bright schools. They will play while the children of those in Donbass, the children of those terrorists, will rot in basements. Zelensky, in 2021, long before the start of our operation, said in an interview answering a question about how he viewed those people on the other side of the front line that there are people and there are creatures. And if you live in Ukraine and feel connected to Russian culture, to Russian civilization, my advice to you, for the sake of your children and grandchildren, is to get the hell out to Russia.
So that's an English translation of Sergei Lavrov. It might even be AI, I'm not sure. It's a pity, because he does speak very good English, that RT decide on their English channel that they've got to put him chatting away in Russian. Now, they really hate speaking English, the Russians. They seem to really hate it.
Well, apart from RT, which is in English.
Well, but I'm talking about the leadership there, Putin and Lavrov.
As you say, Lavrov probably speak in English, and I understand Putin can speak in English, but if they choose not to, then the TV people can't really make them,
can they? It's a pity, because it means
I agree with you. It might make more sense for them to speak in English, because they can communicate
better.
What about
the nub of the issue? Is there ever going to be some... I mean, he's pointing out there, he's saying, well, look, you want these things, you call them security guarantees, but if you're going to be bringing NATO weapons and NATO soldiers in there, that's the reason that the war has started in the first place, so it's not a security guarantee at all.
No, the only real security guarantee for the Ukrainians has to come from the Russians. And the Russians have been saying, we will guarantee your independence and your neutrality and all sorts of other things. But we're the only ones who could, because we're the ones you're fighting, we're the ones who can do an agreement with you if you want. But they don't want, or I understand that public opinion in Ukraine is now very much in favour of some kind of negotiated solution, which again isn't being presented in the West, because factions within the West, like our own Prime Minister, are very much in favour of continuation of the war.
From a very, very down-to-earth practical point of view, what would lead to an end to the Ukraine war?
What I predict will happen, unless there's a general world war with Iran and the collapse of the markets and all the rest of it, is the Russians will eventually capture everything that they said they were going to capture, all the four oblasts which have already voted to leave the Ukraine. And then the general staff will be pushing for, we need to get the Odessa Oblast as well, so that we can link up with the Russian-controlled Transnistria. And Odessa was also always traditionally a very pro-Russian city.
So what I'm trying to say here is,
with the Russians taking
all
of that.
Where is the real centre of this war from a NATO point of view?
What do you mean, the centre?
Where is the war coming from? If you were to destroy, say, a city or a institution in the West somewhere, because it seems to me this is just a proxy war. What I'm saying is, whereabouts in the UK, in Europe, or in the United States is the war being directed from?
Well, I mean, the Russians are very well aware it's being directed from SHAPE in Brussels, which is NATO headquarters. It's being directed from the Ministry of Defence in London, and it's also being directed from the United States. They're not, in fact, neutral in this at all. Now, at some point, the Russians may decide to do precision strikes on all of those top places. Instead of messing around killing the odd paratroop in Ukraine, we're going to kill somebody. Because, of course, a Russian general was nearly assassinated today. He's in hospital, he's probably going to die. Now, the Russians could say, if you're going to shoot our generals like that, you've got a general, Admiral Radikin is the head of the British Armed Forces. We can find him where he is by checking his phone, and maybe we should just kill him.
The Russians are very magnanimous. They say, oh, this is not NATO, this is actually Ukraine that's doing this. But clearly,
they're very well aware that when they say that Ukraine is doing this, they say this is also MI6. The Russians are very well aware that MI6, British, are very much... we've instigated the war. It's our secret services that have created this war.
I wonder, though, it's not just NATO and NATO headquarters in Brussels, that there may be big financial institutions behind this war, too.
That's right, but I mean, the Russians aren't just going to get... I mean, but the Russians, in fact, haven't responded in kind to any of the assassinations of their generals. What they could have done is say, if you're going to assassinate our generals, we're going to assassinate your generals. But in actual fact, they're not doing that. They're killing Ukrainian soldiers on the front line, and they're killing a lot of them. But they're not going to go for the military or political leadership of the other side, because that's not their style. And what they've got to do is they've got to make sure that their generals get a bit more security.
The Russians are thinking about fighting Hitler. Better the devil you know.
Well, I think the thing is, if they do decide to take the gloves off and attack, like a kind of decapitation strike on the West, they won't flag it up beforehand, they'll just do it. And they won't go for one general, they'll go for all of them. Yeah, and they can do it because the missiles they've got, they can actually hit the general's car from inside Russia. Mm. We haven't got anything like that. This general today was shot with a gun by somebody coming up to him and shooting him. If the Russians want to take out the British military leadership, they will fire a missile at them. Mm. And it will be fired from Russia and it will hit them. It will be a big bang and they'll all be dead. It won't be somebody creeping up with a gun.
And that may be taking place in London, which is where we finish this evening. One of my favourite Londoners is a guy called Sam William. He puts together all sorts of interesting videos about the city, and we finish tonight with one of his latest, which is about the creation of a digital god. And what he's looking at here is the rollout, really without hardly any permission from government or anybody else, right across the commercial sector, in shops, in streets, of facial recognition software. And he goes into a little investigation here as to who's behind this and how is it used.
If you subscribe to Facewatch, they'll send somebody to help improve your lighting and to advise you on the best way to position your CCTV cameras to capture excellent biometric data. They actually use your existing cameras, and Facewatch does provide an AI black box to plug your CCTV into. Facewatch doesn't actually record any video. They process the video locally inside their black box, and they only transmit any biometric signatures that they have discovered. The Facewatch cloud has a subject of interest list, which is shared amongst other shops within a certain geographical area. If they suspect somebody of theft or antisocial behaviour, they can upload an image to the Facewatch cloud. That is then shared with all of the other shops so that that person will flag on all of their systems. That's the stuff most people already know. What you may not know is that the Facewatch system has a provision for the Metropolitan Police. The police can add images to the Facewatch cloud, but if someone on the police watch list gets flagged by any shop using Facewatch, the alert actually gets sent directly to the police, and the person in the shop running the system won't even know that that person has been flagged. The shop has effectively become a police live facial recognition van that is totally covert and almost invisible. And when you think about it, the state has just gained a whole load more CCTV coverage without having to pay for any infrastructure. Of course, not every shop actually subscribes to the Facewatch system, so the coverage is fairly patchy, but it is growing. It's growing like a cluster of neurons in a new digital brain. A few years ago, at Willesden Green Underground Station, they did a little experiment. Transport for London wanted to see if they could use their existing CCTV cameras and plug them into a special black box, an AI box, that would analyse people's behaviour, particularly fare evasion. In the olden days, if somebody pushes through the barriers,
they used to confront them. But during the experiment, they decided to let them do it. You see, they wanted to capture behavioral data, and they would let them do it again and again over a number of weeks, the point being that they could then use that data to accurately predict exactly when that individual would turn up next and use that to target them for enforcement procedure. The British Transport Police, this is their headquarters, but they actually have a secret facility as well. It's a CCTV control centre where they monitor all of the railway network's cameras.
Yeah, but it's not allowed to film the building.
Am I speaking to a police officer or am I speaking to a security?
You're speaking to security.
Yeah, so maybe you don't understand that I am allowed to film out here. It's a public road.
Sorry?
I am allowed to film out here. It's a public road.
Yeah, you can film the road, not the building.
No, I definitely can film the building. Could I speak to a police officer, maybe? Could I speak to a police officer? The video I'm making is about BTPTOC ISP001. Right. I'll forgive you if you've never heard of
that's,
it.
Is that
British Transport Police and Train Operating Company's information sharing protocol.
Okay, no worries. Yeah.
So it's basically just about, I mean, I've been
it's
all
a
over
very in-depth policy that probably I'm not privy to.
It's just to do with basically the fact that you guys are monitoring all of the rail network CCTV.
We have access to it, yes.
You have some kind of control room somewhere, which I believe is like top secret. No one's supposed to know where it is because it's like a...
I wouldn't say top secret, but we generally don't broadcast facilities like that.
Obviously. Which is operational security and all that.
Yeah, exactly.
Train operating companies are private companies. It's a bit like a shop, really, except they sell travel rather than goods. And every single camera in the entire jurisdictional area of the British Transport Police goes live to their control centre. Every single train platform, every single stairwell, every corridor, every entranceway.
Bless you, Sam. Fantastic job you're doing. Much, much better than any of those useless mass media people all over London. Well, they do a reasonable job, but they're nowhere near as on the case as you, Martin. This really is a sort of Big Brother society that they'd be creating here. And he's not really, I mean, it seems to me he's not underestimating it when he talks about a digital god. He's saying a kind of surveillance brain is being created and more neurons are being added to it all the time.
Well, the thing that pops into my mind is what Israeli people were saying, or Israeli intelligence people were saying about what they've been doing in Lebanon, which is that Hezbollah are very well aware of being observed by electronic means. So, for example, you know, Hezbollah people will not be going around with mobile phones. They're, the pagers were only for the low-level people, and, of course, they were ultimately booby-trapped. But what they've got now with the AI that the Israeli forces have got is that they can use all of the CCTV footage from shops, because, of course, all sorts of shops have got CCTV footage, and therefore, although they cannot find the exact Hezbollah people they're looking for, they can tell by looking at other things and people that are known associates of theirs and so on, they can use the AI to pinpoint them and then kill them. And of course, this is war fighting stuff. And of course, it's being brought in as policing as well. It's very sinister and very difficult to do anything about.
Well, just in the news today, Kevin Rawlinson writing in The Guardian on the facial recognition. They've got a whole section on it these days. Orwellian Sainsbury's staff are using facial recognition tech. They eject an innocent shopper. A man is misidentified by a London supermarket using a face watch system that we were just hearing about. I shouldn't have to prove that I am not a criminal. The Sainsbury's have now apologised to them. I'm not sure if they gave him a free load of shopping, but he was ordered to leave a supermarket in Elephant and Castle after staff misidentified him using controversial new facial recognition technology. Warren Raja, R-A-J-A-H, was told to abandon his shopping, leave the local store he's been using for several years. after an error in Sainsbury's in St Elephant and Castle. He said supermarket staff could not explain why he was being told to leave and would only direct him to a QR code leading to the website of the firm Facewatch, which retailer has hired to run facial recognition in some of its stores. One of the reasons I was angry was because I shouldn't have to prove that I'm innocent.
Well, this is clearly, you know, overreach. But of course, a lot of people are very unhappy with the amount of shoplifting that goes on in shops, which is causing big problems. So, you know, you can see that. But some people are going to say, "Well, we need something like this to stop all that."
People having not enough money to eat is also causing problems. He said it's somewhere between Minority Report and George Orwell. Minority Report, of course, is that film about this whole idea of pre-crime. We think that you might be the sort of person that might commit a crime, so we're going to prosecute you or exclude you or label you anyway.
Well, I mean, the technological dystopia is upon us, isn't it?
It's a war on God. But God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, particularly to our guest, Paul Williamson, Reverend Paul Williamson. Of course, to all the usual clips and things like that we have on too. Also, of course, to sound engineer Dave Bazanko. Please download this show as an MP3 from 11 p.m. if you like to listen in the car or anywhere you like, and follow Tony Gosling Censored channel on Telegram. Do please share interviews and story tips on my Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group and elsewhere on WhatsApp, Facebook, that sort of thing. Always useful and interesting to hear stuff that you've seen. You think, oh, Tony might like this. Download this show and the full-length interviews, subscribe, and of course the concert this week as well, the Palestine concert. Subscribe to my weekly free newsletter. You can donate or even set up a small monthly sub. Thanks you if you already do that. And that's all at the show page this week, oneword.org.uk. So from a rather chilly nursery in the Coomber Centre, this show is repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday when we bring you the Richie Allen Show live. We're streaming live from Bristol on the Talk Radio stream at djplugradio.co.uk, Nuneaton, Warwickshire, Holy Land Radio, .com from 11 till 2:30 p.m. Central Time, 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app or the Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream this show live or rebroadcast us, just let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
I'm gonna go get some more. I'm